The Chevalier's eyes flashed hatred at Will, and defiance and warning at Lyra, and a cold and wary respect at Yorick. The clarity of his features made all these expressions vivid and bright, as if a light shone on him. Beside him, the Lady Salmakia was emerging from the shadow, and, ignoring the children completely, she made a curtsy to the bear.
"Forgive us,"
she said to Yorick.
"The habit of concealment is hard to break, and my companion, the Chevalier Tialis, and I, the Lady Salmakia, have been among our enemies for so long that, out of pure habit, we neglected to pay you the proper courtesy. We're accompanying this boy and girl to make sure they arrive safely in the care of Lord Asriel. We have no other aim, and certainly no harmful intention towards you, King Yorick Birnison."
If Yorick wondered how any such tiny beings could cause him harm, he didn't show it. Not only was his expression naturally hard to read, but he had his courtesy too, and the lady had spoken graciously enough.
"Come down by the fire. There is food enough and plenty if you are hungry. Will, you began to speak about the knife."
"Yes, and I thought it could never happen. But it's broken. And the alethiometer told Lyra that you'd be able to mend it. I was going to ask more politely, but there it is. Can you mend it, Yorick?"
"Show me."
Will shook all the pieces out of the sheath and laid them on the rocky floor, pushing them about carefully until they were in their right places, and he could see that they were all there. Lyra held a burning branch up, and in its light Yorick bent low to look closely at each piece, touching it delicately with his massive claws and lifting it up to turn it this way and that and examine the break. Will marvelled at the deftness in those huge black hooks. Then Yorick sat up again, his head rearing high into the shadow.
"Yes,"
he said, answering exactly the question and no more. Lyra said, knowing what he meant,
But will you, Yorick? You couldn't believe how important this is. If we can't get it mended, then we're in desperate trouble. And not only us."
"I don't like that knife. I fear what it can do. I have never known anything so dangerous. The most deadly fighting machines are little toys compared to that knife. The harm it can do is unlimited. It would have been infinitely better if it had never been made."
"But with it..."
"With it, you can do strange things. What you don't know is what the knife does on its own. Your intentions may be good. The knife has intentions, too."
"How can that be?"
"The intentions of a tool are what it does. A hammer intends to strike. A vice intends to hold fast. A lever intends to lift. They are what it is made for. But sometimes a tool may have other uses that you don't know. Sometimes in doing what you intend, you also do what the knife intends, without knowing. Can you see the sharpest edge of that knife?"
"No,"
said Will, for it was true. The edge diminished to a thinness so fine that the eye could not reach it.
"Then how can you know everything it does?"
"I can't. But I must still use it and do what I can to help good things come about. If I did nothing, I'd be worse than useless. I'd be guilty."
Lyra was following this closely, and seeing Yorick still unwilling, she said,
"Yorick, you know how wicked those Bolvanga people were. If we can't win, then they're going to be able to carry on doing those kind of things forever. And besides, if we don't have the knife, then they might get hold of it themselves. We never knew about it when I first met you, Yorick, and nor did anyone. But now that we do, we got to use it ourselves. We can't just not. That'd be feeble. And it'd be wrong, too. It'd be just like handing it over to him and saying, 'Go on, use it. We won't stop you.' All right, we don't know what it does. But I can ask the alethiometer, can't I? Then we'd know. And we could think about it properly, instead of just guessing and being afraid."
Will didn't want to mention his own most pressing reason. If the knife was not repaired, he might never get home, never see his mother again. She would never know what had happened. She'd think he'd abandoned her as his father had done. The knife would have been directly responsible for both their desertions. He must use it to return to her, or never forgive himself. Yorick Birnison said nothing for a long time, but turned his head to look out at the darkness. Then he slowly got to his feet and stalked to the cave mouth, and looked up at the stars, some the same as those he knew from the north, and some that were strange to him. Behind him, Lyra turned the meat over on the fire, and Will looked at his wounds to see how they were healing. Tialis and Salmakia sat silent on their ledge. Then Yorick turned around.
Very well. I shall do it on one condition, though I feel it is a mistake. My people have no gods, no ghosts or demons. We live and die, and that is that. Human affairs bring us nothing but sorrow and trouble, but we have language, and we make war, and we use tools. Maybe we should take sides. But full knowledge is better than half knowledge. Lyra, read your instrument. Know what it is that you're asking. If you still want it, then I shall mend the knife.
At once, Lyra took out the alethiometer and edged nearer to the fire so that she could see the face. The reading took her longer than usual, and when she blinked and sighed and came out of the trance, her face was troubled.
I never known it so confused. There was lots of things it said. I think I got it clear. I think so. It said about balance first. It said the knife could be harmful, or it could do good. But it was so slight, such a delicate kind of a balance, that the faintest thought or wish could tip it one way or the other. And it meant you, Will. It meant what you wished or thought. Only it didn't say what would be a good thought or a bad one. Then it said yes,
she said, her eyes flashing at the spies.
It said yes, do it, repair the knife.
Yorick looked at her steadily and then nodded once. Tialis and Salmakia climbed down to watch more closely, and Lyra said,
Do you need more fuel, Yorick? Me and Will could go and fetch some, I'm sure.
Will understood what she meant. Away from the spies, they could talk. Yorick said,
Below the first spur on the track, there is a bush with resinous wood. Bring as much of that as you can.
She jumped up at once, and Will went with her. The moon was brilliant, the path a track of scumbled footprints in the snow, the air cutting and cold. Both of them felt brisk and hopeful and alive. They didn't talk till they were well away from the cave.
What else did it say?
It said some things I didn't understand then, and I still don't understand now. It said the knife would be the death of dust, but then it said it was the only way to keep dust alive. I didn't understand it, Will, but it said again it was dangerous. It kept saying that. It said if we... You know, what I thought.
If we go to the world of the dead.
Yeah, if we do that... It said that we might never come back, Will. We might not survive.
He said nothing, and they walked along more soberly now, watching out for the bush that Yorick had mentioned, and silenced by the thought of what they might be taking on.
We've got to, though, haven't we?
I don't know.
Now we know, I mean. You have to speak to Roger, and I want to speak to my father. We have to now.
I'm frightened.
And he knew she'd never admit that to anyone else.
Did it say what would happen if we didn't?
Just emptiness. Just blankness. I really didn't understand it, Will. But I think it meant that even if it is that dangerous, we should still try and rescue Roger. But it won't be like when I rescued him from Bolvanger. I didn't know what I was doing then, really. I just set off and I was lucky. I mean, there was all kinds of other people to help, like the Egyptians and the witches. There won't be any help where we'd have to go. And I can see. In my dream, I saw... The place was... It was worse than Bolvanger. That's why I'm afraid.
What I'm afraid of,
said Will, not looking at her at all,
is getting stuck somewhere and never seeing my mother again.
From nowhere, a memory came to him. He was very young, and it was before her troubles began. And he was ill. All night long, it seemed, his mother had sat on his bed in the dark, singing nursery rhymes, telling him stories, and as long as her dear voice was there, he knew he was safe. He couldn't abandon her now. He couldn't. He'd look after her all his life long if she needed it. And as if Lyra had known what he was thinking, she said,
Yeah, that's true. That That would be awful. You know, with my mother, I never realised. I just grew up on my own, really. I don't remember anyone ever holding me or cuddling me. It was just me and Pan as far back as I can go. I can't remember Mrs. Lonsdale being like that to me. She was the housekeeper at Jordan College. All she did was make sure I was clean. That's all she thought about. Oh, and manners. But in the cave, Will, I really felt... Oh, it's strange. I know she's done terrible things, but I really felt she was loving me and looking after me. She must have thought I was going to die being asleep all that time. I suppose I must have caught some disease, but she never stopped looking after me. And I remember waking up once or twice, and she was holding me in her arms. I do remember that, I'm sure. That's what I'd do in her place, if I had a child.
So she didn't know why she'd been asleep all that time. Should he tell her and betray that memory, even if it was false? No, of course he shouldn't.
Is that the bush?
The moonlight was brilliant enough to show every leaf. Will snapped off a twig, and the piney, resinous smell stayed strongly on his fingers.
And we ain't going to say anything to those little spies.
They gathered armfuls of the bush and carried them back up towards the cave. Chapter 15. The Forge.
As I was walking among the fires of hell, delighted with the enjoyments of genius. William Blake.
At that moment, the Gallivespians, too, were talking about the knife. Having made a suspicious peace with Yorick Birnison, they climbed back to their ledge to be out of the way, and as the crackle of flames rose and the snapping and roaring of the fire filled the air, Tialis said,
"We must never leave his side. As soon as the knife is mended, we must keep closer than a shadow."
"He is too alert. He watches everywhere for us,"
said Salmakia.
"The girl is more trusting. I think we could win her around. She's innocent and she loves easily. We could work on her. I think we should do that, Tialis."
"But he has the knife. He is the one who can use it."
"He won't go anywhere without her."
"But she has to follow him if he has the knife. And I think that as soon as the knife's intact again, they'll use it to slip into another world so as to get away from us. Did you see how he stopped her from speaking when she was going to say something more? They have some secret purpose, and it's very different from what we want them to do."
"We'll see. But you're right, Tialis, I think. We must stay close to the boy at all costs."
They both watched with some scepticism as Yorick Birnison laid out the tools in his improvised workshop. The mighty workers in the ordnance factories under Lord Asriel's fortress, with their blast furnaces and rolling mills, their anbaric forges and hydraulic presses, would have laughed at the open fire, the stone hammer, the anvil consisting of a piece of Yorick's armour. Nevertheless, the bear had taken the measure of the task, and in the certainty of his movements, the little spies began to see some quality that muffled their scorn. When Lyra and Will came in with the bushes, Yorick directed them in placing branches carefully on the fire. He looked at each branch, turning it from side to side, and then told Will or Lyra to place it at such and such an angle, or to break off part and place it separately at the edge. The result was a fire of extraordinary ferocity, with all its energy concentrated at one side. By this time the heat in the cave was intense. Yorick continued to build the fire, and made the children take two more trips down the path to ensure that there was enough fuel for the whole operation. Then the bear turned over a small stone on the floor and told Lyra to find some more stones of the same kind. He said that those stones, when heated, gave off a gas that would surround the blade and keep the air from it, for if the hot metal came in contact with the air, it would absorb some and be weakened by it. Lyra set about searching, and with owl-eyed Pantalaimon's help soon had a dozen or more stones to hand. Yorick told her how to place them, and where, and showed her exactly the kind of draft she should get moving with a leafy branch to make sure the gas flowed evenly over the workpiece. Will was placed in charge of the fire, and Yorick spent several minutes directing him and making sure he understood the principles he was to use. So much depended on exact placement, and Yorick could not stop and correct each one. Will had to understand, and then he'd do it properly. Furthermore, he mustn't expect the knife to look exactly the same when it was mended. It would be shorter, because each section of the blade would have to overlap the next by a little way so they could be forged together, and the surface would have oxidized a little despite the stone gas, so some of the play of colour would be lost, and no doubt the handle would be charred. but the blade would be just as sharp, and it would work. So Will watched as the flames roared along the resinous twigs, and with streaming eyes and scorched hands he adjusted each fresh branch till the heat was focused, as Yorick wanted it. Meanwhile, Yorick himself was grinding and hammering a fist-sized stone, having rejected several until he found one of the right weight. With massive blows he shaped it and smoothed it, the cordite smell of smashed rocks joining the smoke in the nostrils of the two spies, watching from high up. Even Pantalaimon was active, changing to a crow so he could flap his wings and make the fire burn faster. Eventually the hammer was formed to Yorick's satisfaction, and he set the first two pieces of the blade of the subtle knife among the fierce burning wood at the heart of the fire, and told Lara to begin wafting the stone gas over them. The bear watched, his long white face lurid in the glare, and Will saw the surface of the metal begin to glow red, and then yellow, and then white. Yorick was watching closely, his paw held ready to snatch the pieces out. After a few moments the metal changed again, and the surface became shiny and glistening, and sparks just like those from a firework sprayed up from it. Then Yorick moved. His right paw darted in and seized first one piece and then the other, holding them between the tips of his massive claws and placing them on the slab of iron that was the backplate of his armour. Will could smell the claws burning, but Yorick took no notice of that, and moving with extraordinary speed, he adjusted the angle at which the pieces overlapped, and then raised his left paw high and struck a blow with the rock hammer. The knife tip leapt on the rock under the massive blow. Will was thinking that the whole of the rest of his life depended on what happened in that tiny triangle of metal, that point that searched out the gaps inside the atoms, and all his nerves trembled, sensing every flicker of every flame and the loosening of every atom in the lattice of the metal. Before this began, he had supposed that only a full-scale furnace with the finest tools and equipment could work on that blade. But now he saw that these were the finest tools, and that Yorick's artistry had constructed the best furnace there could be. Yorick roared above the clangor,
"Hold it still in your mind! You have to forge it too! This is your task as much as mine!"
Will felt his whole being quiver under the blows of the stone hammer in the bear's fist. The second piece of the blade was heating, too, and Lyra's leafy branch sent the hot gas along to bathe both pieces in its flow and keep out the iron-eating air. Will sensed it all and felt the atoms of the metal linking each to each across the fracture, forming new crystals again, strengthening and straightening themselves in the invisible lattice as the join came good.
"The edge!"
roared Yorick.
"Hold the edge in line!"
He meant, "with your mind." And Will did it instantly, sensing the minute snags and then the minute easement as the edges lined up perfectly. Then that join was made, and Yorick turned to the next piece.
"A new stone!"
he called to Lyra, who knocked the first one aside and placed a second on the spot to heat. Will checked the fuel and snapped a branch in two to direct the flames better, and Yorick began to work with the hammer once more. Will felt a new layer of complexity added to his task, because he had to hold the new piece in a precise relationship with both the previous two, and he understood that only by doing that accurately could he help Yorick mend it. So the work continued. He had no idea how long it took. Lyra, for her part, found her arms aching, her eyes streaming, her skin scorched and red, and every bone in her body aching with fatigue. But still she placed each stone as Yorick had told her, and still the weary Pantalaimon raised his wings readily and beat them over the flames. When it came to the final join, Will's head was ringing, and he was so exhausted by the intellectual effort he could barely lift the next branch onto the fire. He had to understand every connection, or the knife would not hold together. And when it came to the most complex one, the last, which would have fixed the nearly finished blade onto the small part remaining at the handle, if he couldn't hold it in his full consciousness together with all the others, then the knife would simply fall apart as if Yorick had never begun. The bear sensed this too and paused before he began heating the last piece. He looked at Will, and in his eyes Will could see nothing, no expression, just a bottomless black brilliance. Nevertheless, he understood. This was work, and it was hard, but they were equal to it, all of them. That was enough for Will, so he turned back to the fire and sent his imagination out to the broken end of the haft and braced himself for the last and fiercest part of the task. So he and Yorick and Lyra together forged the knife, and how long the final join took he had no idea. But when Yorick had struck the final blow, and Will had felt the final tiny settling as the atoms connected across the break, Will sank down onto the floor of the cave and let exhaustion possess him. Lyra nearby was in the same state, her eyes glassy and red-rimmed, her hair full of soot and smoke. And Yorick himself stood heavy-headed, his fur singed in several places, dark streaks of ash marking its rich cream-white. Tialis and Salmakia had slept in turns, one of them always alert. Now she was awake and he was sleeping, but as the blade cooled from red to grey and finally to silver, and as Will reached out for the handle, she woke her partner with a hand on his shoulder. He was alert at once. But Will didn't touch the knife. He held his palm close by, and the heat was still too great for his hand. The spies relaxed on the rocky shelf, as Yorick said to Will,
"Come outside."
Then he said to Lyra,
"Stay here, and don't touch the knife."
Lyra sat close to the anvil, where the knife lay cooling, and Yorick told her to bank the fire up and not let it burn down. There was a final operation yet. Will followed the great bear out onto the dark mountainside. The cold was bitter and instantaneous after the inferno in the cave.
"They should not have made that knife,"
said Yorick, after they had walked a little way.
"Maybe I should not have mended it. I'm troubled, and I have never been troubled before, never in doubt. Now I am full of doubt. Doubt is a human thing, not a bear thing. If I am becoming human, something's wrong, something's bad. And I've made it worse."
"But when the first bear made the first piece of armor, wasn't that bad too in the same way?"
Yorick was silent. They walked on till they came to a big drift of snow, and Yorick lay in it and rolled this way and that, sending flurries of snow up into the dark air, so that it looked as if he himself were made of snow. He was the personification of all the snow in the world. When he was finished, he rolled over and stood up and shook himself vigorously, and then, seeing Will still waiting for an answer to his question, said,
"Yes, I think it might have been too. But before that first armored bear, there were no others. We know of nothing before that. That was when custom began. We know our customs, and they are firm and solid, and we follow them without change. Bear nature is weak without custom, as bear flesh is unprotected without armor. But I think I have stepped outside bear nature in mending this knife. I think I've been as foolish as Jofur Ragnarsson. Time will tell. But I am uncertain and doubtful. Now you must tell me, why did the knife break?"
Will rubbed his aching head with both hands.
"The woman looked at me, and I thought she had the face of my mother,"
he said, trying to recollect the experience with all the honesty he had.
"And the knife came up against something it couldn't cut. And because my mind was pushing it through and forcing it back both at the same time, it snapped. That's what I think. The woman knew what she was doing, I'm sure. She's very clever."
"When you talk of the knife, you talk of your mother and father."
"Do I? Yes, I suppose I do."
"What are you going to do with it?"
"I don't know."
Suddenly Yorick lunged at Will and cuffed him hard with his left paw, so hard that Will fell half-stunned into the snow and tumbled over and over until he ended some way down the slope with his head ringing. Yorick came down slowly to where Will was struggling up and said,
"Answer me truthfully."
Will was tempted to say, "You wouldn't have done that if I'd had the knife in my hand." But he knew that Yorick knew that, and knew that he knew it, and that it would be discourteous and stupid to say it. But he was tempted all the same. He held his tongue until he was standing upright, facing Yorick directly.
"I said I don't know,"
he said, trying hard to keep his voice calm.
"Because I haven't looked clearly at what it is that I'm going to do, at what it means. It frightens me, and it frightens Lyra too. Anyway, I agreed as soon as I heard what she said."
"And what was that?"
"We want to go down to the land of the dead and talk to the ghost of Lyra's friend Roger, the one who got killed on Svalbard. And if there really is a world of the dead, then my father will be there too. And if we can talk to ghosts, I want to talk to him. But I'm divided, I'm pulled apart. Because also I want to go back and look after my mother, because I could. And also, the angel, Balthamus, told me I should go to Lord Asriel and offer the knife to him, and I think maybe he was right as well.
He fled.
He wasn't a warrior. He did as much as he could, and then he couldn't do any more. He wasn't the only one to be afraid. I'm afraid, too. So I have to think it through. Maybe sometimes we don't do the right thing because the wrong thing looks more dangerous, and we don't want to look scared, so we go and do the wrong thing just because it's dangerous. We're more concerned with not looking scared than with judging right. It's very hard. That's why I didn't answer you.
I see.
They stood in silence for what felt like a long time, especially to Will, who had little protection from the bitter cold. But Yorick hadn't finished yet, and Will was still weak and dizzy from the blow and didn't quite trust his feet, so they stayed where they were.
Well, I have compromised myself in many ways,
said the Bear King.
It may be that in helping you, I have brought final destruction on my kingdom. And it may be that I have not, and that destruction was coming anyway. Maybe I have held it off. So I am troubled, having to do unbear-like deeds and speculate and doubt like a human. And I shall tell you one thing. You know it already, but you don't want to, which is why I tell you openly, so that you don't mistake it. If you want to succeed in this task, you must no longer think about your mother. You must put her aside. If your mind is divided, the knife will break. Now I'm going to say farewell to Lyra. You must wait in the cave. Those two spies will not let you out of their sight, and I do not want them listening when I speak to her.
Will had no words, though his breast and his throat were full. He managed to say,
Thank you, Yorick Birnison.
But that was all he could say. Will walked with Yorick up the slope towards the cave, where the fire glow still shone warmly in the vast surrounding dark. There Yorick carried out the last process in the mending of the subtle knife. He laid it among the brighter cinders until the blade was glowing, and Will and Lyra saw 100 colours swirling in the smoky depths of the metal. And when he judged the moment was right, Yorick told Will to take it and plunge it directly into the snow that drifted outside. The rosewood handle was charred and scorched, but Will wrapped his hand in several folds of a shirt and did as Yorick told him. In the hiss and flare of steam, he felt the atoms finally settle together, and he knew that the knife was as keen as before, the point as infinitely rare. But it did look different. It was shorter and much less elegant, and there was a dull silver surface over each of the joins. It looked ugly now. It looked like what it was. Wounded. When it was cool enough, he packed it away in the rucksack and sat, ignoring the spies, to wait for Lyra to come back. Yorick had taken her a little further up the slope, to a point out of sight of the cave, and there he had let her sit cradled in the shelter of his great arms, with Pantalaimon nestling mouse-formed at her breast. Yorick bent his head over her and nuzzled at her scorched and smoky hands. Without a word, he began to lick them clean. His tongue was soothing on the burns, and she felt as safe as she had ever felt in her life. But when her hands were free of soot and dirt, Yorick spoke. She felt his voice vibrate against her back.
Lyra Silvertongue, what is this plan to visit the dead?
It came to me in a dream, Yorick. I saw Roger's ghost, and I knew he was calling to me. You remember Roger? Well, after we left you, he was killed, and it was my fault. At least I felt it was. And I think I should just finish what I began, that's all. I should go and say sorry. And if I can, I should rescue him from there. If Will can open a way to the world of the dead, then we must do it.
Can is not the same as must.
But if you must, and you can, then there's no excuse.
While you are alive, your business is with life.
No, Yorick. Our business is to keep promises, no matter how difficult they are. You know, secretly, I'm deadly scared. And I wish I'd never had that dream. And I wish Will hadn't thought of using the knife to go there. But we did, so we can't get out of it.
Lyra felt Pantalaimon trembling and stroked him with her sore hands.
We don't know how to get there, though. We won't know anything till we try. What are you going to do, Yorick?
I'm going back north with my people. We can't live in the mountains. Even the snow is different. I thought we could live here, but we can live more easily in the sea, even if it is warm. That was worth learning. And besides, I think we will be needed. I can feel war, Lyra Silvertongue. I can smell it. I can hear it. I spoke to Serafina Pecola before I came this way, and she told me she was going to Lord Fa and the Egyptians. If there is war, we shall be needed.
Lyra sat up, excited at hearing the names of her old friends. But Yorick hadn't finished.
If you do not find a way out of the world of the dead, we shall not meet again, because I have no ghost. My body will remain on the earth and then become part of it. But if it turns out that you and I both survive, then you will always be a welcome and honored visitor to Svalbard. And the same is true of Will. Has he told you what happened when we met?
No, except that it was by a river.
He outfaced me. I thought no one could ever do that, but this half-grown boy was too daring for me, and too clever. I am not happy that you should do what you plan, but there is no one I would trust to go with you except that boy. You are worthy of each other. Go well, Lyra Silvertongue, my dear friend.
She reached up and put her arms around his neck and pressed her face into his fur, unable to speak. After a minute, he stood up gently and disengaged her arms, and then he turned and walked silently away into the dark. Lyra thought his outline was lost almost at once against the pallor of the snow-covered ground, but it might have been that her eyes were full of tears. When Will heard her footsteps on the path, he looked at the spies.
Don't you move. Look, here's the knife. I'm not going to use it. Stay here.
He went outside and found Lyra standing still, weeping, with Pantalaimon as a wolf raising his face to the black sky. She was quite silent. The only light came from the pale reflection in the snowbank of the remains of the fire, and that in turn was reflected from her wet cheeks, and her tears found their own reflection in Will's eyes, and so those photons wove the two children together in a silent web.
I love him so much, Will. And he looked old. He looked hungry and old and sad. Is it all coming on to us now, Will? We can't rely on anyone else now, can we? It's just us. But we ain't old enough yet. We're only young. We're too young. If poor Mr. Scoresby's dead and Yorick's old, it's all coming on to us. What's got to be done?
We can do it. I'm not going to look back any more. We can do it. But we've got to sleep now. And if we stay in this world, those gyropter things might come. The ones the spies sent for. I'm going to cut through now, and we'll find another world to sleep in. And if the spies come with us, that's too bad. We'll have to get rid of them another time.
Yes.
She sniffed and wiped the back of her hand across her nose and rubbed her eyes with both palms.
Let's do that. You sure the knife will work? You tested it.
I know it'll work.
With Pantalaimon tiger-formed to deter the spies, they hoped, Will and Lyra went back and picked up their rucksacks.
What are you doing?
Said Selmakia.
Going into another world,
said Will, taking out the knife. It felt like being whole again. He hadn't realized how much he loved it.
But you must wait for Lord Asriel's gyropters,
said Tialis.
We're not going to. If you come near the knife, I'll kill you. Come through with us if you must, but you can't make us stay here. We're leaving.
You lied.
No, I lied. Will doesn't lie. You didn't think of that.
But where are you going?
Will didn't answer. He felt forward in the dim air and cut an opening. Selmakia said,
This is a mistake. You should realize that and listen to us. You haven't thought...
Yes, we have. We've thought hard. And we'll tell you what we've thought tomorrow. You can come where we're going, or you can go back to Lord Asriel.
The window opened onto the world into which he had escaped with Baruch and Balthamos, and where he'd slept safely. The warm, endless beach with the fern-like trees behind the dunes.
Here. We'll sleep here. This'll do.
He let them through and closed it behind them at once. While he and Lyra lay down where they were, exhausted, the Lady Salmakia kept watch, and the Chevalier opened his lodestone resonator and began to play a message into the dark. Chapter 16. The Intention Craft.
From the arched roof, pendant by subtle magic, many a row of starry lamps and blazing cressets, fed with naphtha and asphaltus, yielded light. John Milton.
My child, my daughter, where is she? What have you done? My Lyra! You'd do better to tear the fibres from my heart. She was safe with me, safe! And now where is she?
Mrs. Coulter's cry resounded through the little chamber at the top of the adamant tower. She was bound to a chair, her hair dishevelled, her clothing torn, her eyes wild, and her monkey demon thrashed and struggled on the floor in the coils of a silver chain. Lord Asriel sat nearby, scribbling on a piece of paper, taking no notice. An orderly stood beside him, glancing nervously at the woman. When Lord Asriel handed him the paper, he saluted and hurried out, his terrier demon close at his heels with her tail tucked low. Lord Asriel turned to Mrs. Coulter.
Lyra, frankly, I don't care. The wretched child should have stayed where she was put and done what she was told. I can't waste any more time or resources on her. If she refuses to be helped, let her deal with the consequences.
You don't mean that, Asriel, or you wouldn't
have... I mean every word of it. The fuss she's caused is out of all proportion to her merits. An ordinary English girl, not very clever...
She is.
All right. Bright, but not intellectual. Impulsive. Dishonest, greedy...
Brave, generous, loving...
A perfectly ordinary child, distinguished by nothing...
Perfectly ordinary? Lyra? She's unique. Think of what she's done already. Dislike her if you will, Asriel. But don't you dare patronise your daughter. And she was safe with me until...
You're right,
he said, getting up.
She is unique. To have tamed and softened you, that's no everyday feat. She's drawn your poison, Marisa. She's taken your teeth out. Your fire's been quenched in a drizzle of sentimental piety. Who would have thought it? The pitiless agent of the church, the fanatical persecutor of children, the inventor of hideous machines to slice them apart and look in their terrified little beings for any evidence of sin. And along comes a foul-mouthed, ignorant little brat with dirty fingernails, and you cluck and settle your feathers over her like a hen. Well, I admit, the child must have some gift I've never seen myself. But if all it does is turn you into a doting mother, it's a pretty thin, drab, puny little gift. And now you might as well be quiet. I've asked my chief commanders to come in for an urgent conference, and if you can't control your noise, I'll have you gagged.
Mrs. Coulter was more like her daughter than she knew. Her answer to this was to spit in Lord Asriel's face. He wiped it calmly away and said,
A gag would put an end to that kind of behaviour, too.
Oh, do correct me, Asriel. Someone who displays to his under-officers a captive tied to a chair is clearly a prince of politeness. Untie me, or I'll force you to gag me.
As you wish.
He took a silk scarf from the drawer, but before he could tie it around her mouth, she shook her head.
No, no, Asriel, don't. I beg you, please don't humiliate me.
Angry tears dashed from her eyes.
Very well. I'll untie you. But he can stay in his chains.
He dropped the scarf back in the drawer before cutting her bonds with a clasp knife. She rubbed her wrists, stood up, stretched, and only then noticed the condition of her clothes and hair. She looked haggard and pale. The last of the Gallivespian venom still remained in her body, causing agonizing pains in her joints, but she was not going to show him that. Lord Asriel said,
You can wash in there.
Indicating a small room hardly bigger than a closet. She picked up her chained demon, whose baleful eyes glared at Lord Asriel over her shoulder, and went through to make herself tidier. The orderly came in to announce,
His Majesty King Ogunwe and the Lord Roke.
The African general and the Gallivespian came in, King Ogunwe in a clean uniform, with a wound on his temple freshly dressed, and Lord Roke gliding swiftly to the table astride his blue hawk. Lord Asriel greeted them warmly and offered wine. The bird let his rider step off, and then flew to the bracket by the door as the orderly announced the third of Lord Asriel's high commanders, an angel by the name of Zaphania. She was of a much higher rank than Baruch or Balthamos, and visible by a shimmering, disconcerting light that seemed to come from somewhere else. By this time Mrs. Coulter had emerged, much tidied, and all three commanders bowed to her, and if she was surprised at their appearance, she gave no sign, but inclined her head and sat down peaceably, holding the pinioned monkey in her arms. Without wasting time, Lord Asriel said,
"Tell me what happened, King Ogunwe."
The African, powerful and deep-voiced, said,
"We killed 17 Swiss guards and destroyed 2 zeppelins. We lost 5 men and 1 gyropter. The girl and the boy escaped. We captured the Lady Coulter, despite her courageous defense, and brought her here. I hope she feels we treated her courteously."
"I am quite content with the way you treated me, sir."
"Any damage to the other gyropters? Any wounded?"
"Some damage and some wounds, but all minor."
"Good. Thank you, King. Your force did well. My Lord Roke, what have you heard?"
The Gallivespian said,
"My spies are with the boy and girl in another world. Both children are safe and well, though the girl has been kept in a drugged sleep for many days. The boy lost the use of his knife during the events in the cave. By some accident, it broke in pieces. But it is now whole again, thanks to a creature from the north of your world, Lord Asriel. A giant bear, very skilled at smithwork. As soon as the knife was mended, the boy cut through into another world where they are now. My spies are with them, of course, but there is a difficulty. While the boy has the knife, he cannot be compelled to do anything. And yet, if they were to kill him in his sleep, the knife would be useless to us. For the time being, the Chevalier Tialis and the Lady Salmakia will go with them wherever they go, so at least we can keep track of them. They seem to have a plan in mind. They are refusing to come here, at any rate. My two will not lose them."
"Are they safe in this other world they're in now?"
"They're on a beach near a forest of large tree ferns. There is no sign of animal life nearby. As we speak, both boy and girl are asleep. I spoke to the Chevalier Tialis not 5 minutes ago."
"Thank you. Now that your two agents are following the children, of course, we have no eyes in the Magisterium any more. We shall have to rely on the alethiometer. At least..."
Then Mrs. Coulter spoke, to their surprise.
"I don't know about the other branches, but as far as the consistorial court is concerned, the reader they rely on is Fra Pavel Rushek, and he's thorough, but slow. They won't know where Lyra is for another few hours."
"Thank you, Marisa. Do you have any idea what Lyra and this boy intend to do next?"
"No, none. I've spoken to the boy, and he seemed to be a stubborn child and one well used to keeping secrets. I can't guess what he would do. As for Lyra, she is quite impossible to read."
"My lord,"
said King Ogunwe,
"may we know whether the lady is now part of this commanding council? If so, what is her function? If not, should she not be taken elsewhere?"
"She is our captive and my guest, and as a distinguished former agent of the church, she may have information that would be useful."
"Will she reveal anything willingly, or will she need to be tortured?"
said Lord Roke, watching her directly as he spoke.
"I would have thought Lord Asriel's commanders would know better than to expect truth to come out of torture."
Lord Asriel couldn't help enjoying her barefaced insincerity.
"I will guarantee Mrs. Coulter's behavior. She knows what will happen if she betrays us, though she will not have the chance. However, if any of you has a doubt, express it now, fearlessly."
"I do, but I doubt you, not her."
"Why?"
"If she tempted you, you would not resist. It was right to capture her, but wrong to invite her to this council. Treat her with every courtesy, give her the greatest comfort, but place her somewhere else and stay away from her."
"Well, I invited you to speak, and I must accept your rebuke. I value your presence more than hers, King. I'll have her taken away."
He reached for the bell, but before he could ring, Mrs. Coulter spoke.
Please, listen to me first. I can help. I've been closer to the heart of the Magisterium than anyone you're likely to find again. I know how they think. I can guess what they'll do. You wonder why you should trust me. What's made me leave them? It's simple. They're going to kill my daughter. They daren't let her live. The moment I found out who she is, what the witches prophesy about her, I knew I had to leave the church. I knew I was their enemy and they were mine. I didn't know what you all were or what I was to you. That was a mystery. But I knew that I had to set myself against the church, against everything they believed in, and if need be, against the authority himself.
She stopped. All the commanders were listening intently. Now she looked Lord Asriel full in the face and seemed to speak to him alone, her voice low and passionate, her brilliant eyes glittering.
I have been the worst mother in the world. I let my only child be taken away from me when she was a tiny infant, because I didn't care about her. I was concerned only with my own advancement. I didn't think of her for years. And if I did, it was only to regret the embarrassment of her birth. But then the church began to take an interest in dust and in children. And something stirred in my heart. And I remembered that I was a mother and Lyra was my child. And because there was a threat, I saved her from it. 3 times now, I've stepped in to pluck her out of danger. First, when the Ablation Board began its work, I went to Jordan College and I took her to live with me in London, where I could keep her safe from the board, or so I hoped, but she ran away. The second time was at Bulvanga, when I found her just in time under the blade of the... My heart nearly stopped. It was what they, we, what I had done to other children. But when it was mine... Oh, you can't conceive the horror of that moment. I hope you never suffer as I did then. But I got her free. I took her out. I saved her a second time. But even as I did that, I still felt myself part of the church. A servant. A loyal and faithful and devoted servant, because I was doing the authority's work. And then I learned the witch's prophecy. Lyra will somehow, sometime soon, be tempted, as Eve was. That's what they say. What form this temptation will take, I don't know. But she's growing up, after all, it's not hard to imagine. And now that the church knows that too, they'll kill her. If it all depends on her, could they risk letting her live? Would they dare take the chance that she'd refuse this temptation, whatever it will be? No. They're bound to kill her. If they could, they'd go back to the Garden of Eden and kill Eve before she was tempted. Killing is not difficult for them. Calvin himself ordered the deaths of children. They'd kill her with pomp and ceremony and prayers and lamentations and psalms and hymns, but they would kill her. If she falls into their hands, she's dead already. So when I heard what the witch said, I saved my daughter for the 3rd time. I took her to a place where I kept her safe, and there I was going to stay.
You drugged her. You kept her unconscious.
I had to, because she hated me. She feared and hated me, and she would have fled from my presence like a bird from a cat if I hadn't drugged her into oblivion. Do you know what that means to a mother? But it was the only way to keep her safe. All that time in the cave... Asleep, her eyes closed, her body helpless, a demon curled up at her throat. Oh, I felt such a love, such a tenderness, such a deep, deep... My own child. The first time I had ever been able to do these things for her, my little... I washed her. And fed her and kept her safe and warm. I made sure her body was nourished as she slept. I lay beside her at night. I cradled her in my arms. I wept into her hair. I kissed her sleeping eyes, my little one.
She was shameless. She spoke quietly. She didn't declaim or raise her voice. and when a sob shook her, it was muffled almost into a hiccup, as if she were stifling her emotions for the sake of courtesy, which made her barefaced lies all the more effective, Lord Asriel thought with disgust. She lied in the very marrow of her bones. She directed her words mainly at King Ogunwe, without seeming to, and Lord Asriel saw that, too. Not only was the king her chief accuser, he was also human, unlike the angel or Lord Roke, and she knew how to play on him. In fact, though, it was on the Gallivespian that she made the greatest impression. Lord Roke sensed in her a nature as close to that of a scorpion as he had ever encountered, and he was well aware of the power in the sting he could detect under her gentle tone. Better to keep scorpions where you could see them, he thought. So he supported King Ogunwe when the latter changed his mind and argued that she should stay, and Lord Asriel found himself outflanked, for he now wanted her elsewhere, but he had already agreed to abide by his commander's wishes. Mrs. Coulter looked at him with an expression of mild and virtuous concern. He was certain that no one else could see the glitter of sly triumph in the depths of her beautiful eyes.
Stay, then. But you've spoken enough. Stay quiet now. I want to consider this proposal for a garrison on the southern border. You've all seen the report. Is it workable? Is it desirable? Next, I want to look at the armory, and then I want to hear from Zafania about the dispositions of the angelic forces. First the garrison, King Ogunwe.
The African leader began. They spoke for some time, and Mrs. Coulter was impressed by their accurate knowledge of the church's defences, and their clear assessment of its leader's strengths. But now that Tialis and Salmakia were with the children, and Lord Asriel no longer had a spy in the magisterium, their knowledge would soon be dangerously out of date. An idea came to Mrs. Coulter's mind, and she and the monkey demon exchanged a glance that felt like a powerful Anbaric spark. But she said nothing, and stroked his golden fur as she listened to the commanders. Then Lord Asriel said,
"Enough. That is a problem we'll deal with later. Now for the armory. I understand they're ready to test the intention craft. We'll go and look at it."
He took a silver key from his pocket and unlocked the chain around the golden monkey's feet and hands, and carefully avoided touching even the tip of one golden hair. Lord Roke mounted his hawk and followed with the others as Lord Asriel set off down the stairs of the tower and out onto the battlements. A cold wind was blowing, snapping at their eyelids, and the dark blue hawk soared up in a mighty draught, wheeling and screaming in the wild air. King Ogunwe drew his coat around him and rested his hand on his cheetah demon's head. Mrs. Coulter said humbly to the angel,
"Excuse me, my lady. Your name is Zephania."
"Yes,"
said the angel. Her appearance impressed Mrs. Coulter, just as her fellows had impressed the witch Rutaskadi when she found them in the sky. She was not shining, but shone on, though there was no source of light. She was tall, naked, winged, and her lined face was older than that of any living creature Mrs. Coulter had ever seen.
"Are you one of the angels who rebelled so long ago?"
"Yes. And since then I have been wandering between many worlds. Now I have pledged my allegiance to Lord Asriel, because I see in his great enterprise the best hope of destroying the tyranny at last."
"But if you fail?"
"Then we shall all be destroyed, and cruelty will reign forever."
As they spoke, they followed Lord Asriel's rapid strides along the wind-beaten battlements towards a mighty staircase going down so deep that even the flaring lights on sconces down the walls could not disclose the bottom. Past them swooped the blue hawk, gliding down and down into the gloom, with each flaring light making his feathers flicker as he passed it, until he was merely a tiny spark, and then nothing. The angel had moved on to Lord Asriel's side, and Mrs. Coulter found herself descending next to the African king.
"Excuse my ignorance, sir, but I had never seen or heard of a being like the man on the blue hawk until the fight in the cave yesterday. Where does he come from? Can you tell me about his people? I wouldn't offend him for the world, but if I speak without knowing something about him, I might be unintentionally rude."
"You do well to ask," said King Ogunwe. "His people are proud. Their world developed unlike ours. There are two kinds of conscious being there. Humans and Gallivespians. The humans are mostly servants of the authority, and they have been trying to exterminate the small people since the earliest time anyone can remember. They regard them as diabolic, so the Gallivespians still cannot quite trust those who are our size. But they are fierce and proud warriors and deadly enemies and valuable spies."
"Are all his people with you, or are they divided as humans are?"
There are some who are with the enemy, but most are with us.
And the angels? You know, I thought until recently that angels were an invention of the Middle Age. They were just imaginary. To find yourself speaking to one is disconcerting, isn't it? How many are with Lord Asriel?
Mrs. Coulter, these questions are just the sort of things a spy would want to find out.
A fine sort of spy I'd be to ask you so transparently. I'm a captive, sir. I couldn't get away even if I had a safe place to flee to. From now on, I'm harmless. You can take my word for that.
If you say so, I am happy to believe you. Angels are more difficult to understand than any human being. They're not all of one kind to begin with. Some have greater powers than others, and there are complicated alliances among them and ancient enmities that we know little about. The Authority has been suppressing them since he came into being.
She stopped. She was genuinely shocked. The African king halted beside her, thinking she was unwell, and indeed the light of the flaring sconce above her did throw ghastly shadows over her face.
You say that so casually, as if it were something I should know too, but how can it be? The Authority created the worlds, didn't he? He existed before everything. How can he have come into being?
This is angelic knowledge. It shocks some of us to learn that the Authority is not the creator. There may have been a creator, or there may not. We don't know. All we know is that at some point, the Authority took charge, and since then, angels have rebelled and human beings have struggled against him too. This is the last rebellion. Never before have humans and angels and beings from all the worlds made a common cause. This is the greatest force ever assembled, but it may still not be enough. We shall see.
But what does Lord Asriel intend? What is this world, and why has he come here?
He led us here because this world is empty. Empty of conscious life, that is. We are not colonialists, Mrs. Coulter. We haven't come to conquer, but to build.
And is he going to attack the Kingdom of Heaven?
Ogunwe looked at her levelly.
We're not going to invade the Kingdom. But if the Kingdom invades us, they had better be ready for war because we are prepared. Mrs. Coulter, I am a king. But it's my proudest task to join Lord Asriel in setting up a world where there are no kingdoms at all. No kings, no bishops, no priests. The Kingdom of Heaven has been known by that name since the Authority first set himself above the rest of the angels, and we want no part of it. This world is different. We intend to be free citizens of the Republic of Heaven.
Mrs. Coulter wanted to say more, to ask the dozen questions that rose to her lips, but the king had moved on, unwilling to keep his commander waiting, and she had to follow. The staircase led so far down that by the time it reached a level floor, the sky behind them at the head of the flight was quite invisible. Well before halfway, she had little breath left, but she made no complaint and moved on down till it opened out into a massive hall, lit by glowing crystals in the pillars that supported the roof. Ladders, gantries, beams and walkways crossed the gloom above, with small figures moving about them purposefully. Lord Asriel was speaking to his commanders when Mrs. Coulter arrived, and without waiting to let her rest, he moved on across the great hall, where occasionally a bright figure would sweep through the air or alight on the floor for a brief snatched word with him. The air was dense and warm. Mrs. Coulter noticed that, presumably as a courtesy to Lord Roke, every pillar had an empty bracket at human head height so that his hawk could perch there and allow the Gallivespian to be included in the discussion. But they did not stay in the great hall for long. At the far side, an attendant hauled open a heavy double door to let them through, onto the platform of a railway. There waiting was a small closed carriage, drawn by an Anbaric locomotive. The engineer bowed, and his brown monkey demon retreated behind his legs at the sight of the golden monkey with the chained hands. Lord Asriel spoke to the man briefly, and showed the others into the carriage, which, like the hall, was lit by those glowing crystals, held on silver brackets against mirrored mahogany panels. As soon as Lord Asriel had joined them, the train began to move, gliding smoothly away from the platform and into a tunnel, accelerating briskly. Only the sound of the wheels on the smooth track gave any idea of their speed.
"Where are we going?"
Mrs. Coulter asked.
"To the armory,"
Lord Asriel said shortly, and turned away to talk quietly with the angel. Mrs. Coulter said to Lord Roke,
"My lord, are your spies always sent out in pairs?"
"Why do you ask?"
"Simple curiosity. My demon and I found ourselves at a stalemate when we met them recently in that cave, and I was intrigued to see how well they fought."
"Why intrigued? Did you not expect people of our size to be good fighters?"
She looked at him coolly, aware of the ferocity of his pride.
No. I thought we would beat you easily, and you very nearly beat us. I'm happy to admit my mistake. But do you always fight in pairs?
You are a pair, are you not? You and your demon? Did you expect us to concede the advantage?
His haughty stare, brilliantly clear even in the soft light of the crystals, dared her to ask more. She looked down modestly and said nothing. Several minutes went past, and Mrs. Coulter felt the train taking them downwards, even deeper into the mountain's heart. She couldn't guess how far they went, but when at least 15 minutes had gone by, the train began to slow, and presently they drew up to a platform where the Anbaric lights seemed brilliant after the darkness of the tunnel. Lord Asriel opened the doors, and they got out into an atmosphere so hot and sulphur-laden that Mrs. Coulter had to gasp. The air rang with the pounding of mighty hammers and the clangorous screech of iron on stone. An attendant hauled open the doors leading off the platform, and instantly the noise redoubled and the heat swept over them like a breaking wave. A blaze of scorching light made them shade their eyes. Only Zaphania seemed unaffected by the onslaught of sound and light and heat. When her senses had adjusted, Mrs. Coulter looked around, alive with curiosity. She had seen forges, ironworks, manufactories in her own world. The biggest seemed like a village smithy beside this. Hammers the size of houses were lifted in a moment to the distant ceiling, and then hurled downward to flatten bulks of iron the size of tree trunks, pounding them flat in a fraction of a second with a blow that made the very mountain tremble. From a vent in the rocky wall, a river of sulphurous molten metal flowed until it was cut off by an adamant gate, and the brilliant seething flood rushed through channels and sluices and over weirs into row upon row of moulds to settle and cool in a cloud of evil smoke. Gigantic slicing machines and rollers cut and folded and pressed sheets of inch-thick iron as if it were tissue paper, and then those monstrous hammers pounded it flat again, layering metal upon metal with such force that the different layers became one tougher one, over and over again. If Yorick Birnison could have seen this armory, he might have admitted that these people knew something about working with metal. Mrs. Coulter could only look and wonder. It was impossible to speak and be understood, and no one tried. And now Lord Asriel was gesturing to the small group to follow him along a grated walkway suspended over an even larger vault below, where miners toiled with picks and spades to hack the bright metals from the mother rock. They passed over the walkway and down a long rocky corridor, where stalactites hung gleaming with strange colours and where the pounding and grinding and hammering gradually faded. Mrs. Coulter could feel a cool breeze on her heated face. The crystals that gave them light were neither mounted on sconces nor enclosed in glowing pillars, but scattered loosely on the floor, and there were no flaring torches to add to the heat. So little by little the party began to feel cold again, and presently they came out quite suddenly into the night air. They were at a place where part of the mountain had been hacked away, making a space as wide and open as a parade ground. Further along they could see, dimly lit, great iron doors in the mountainside, some open and some shut, and from out of one of the mighty doorways men were hauling something draped in a tarpaulin.
"What is that?"
Mrs. Coulter said to the African king.
"The intention craft."
Mrs. Coulter had no idea what that could mean, and watched with intense curiosity as they prepared to take off the tarpaulin. She stood close to King Ogunwe, as if for shelter, and said,
"How does it work? What does it do?"
"We're about to see."
It looked like some kind of complex drilling apparatus, or the cockpit of a gyropter, or the cabin of a massive crane. It had a glass canopy over a seat, with at least a dozen levers and handles banked in front of it. It stood on 6 legs, each jointed and sprung at a different angle to the body, so that it seemed both energetic and ungainly. And the body itself was a mass of pipework, cylinders, pistons, coiled cables, switchgear, valves, and gauges. It was hard to tell what was structure and what was not, because it was only lit from behind, and most of it was hidden in gloom. Lord Roke on his hawk had glided up to it directly, circling above, examining it from all sides. Lord Asriel and the Angel were close in discussion with the engineers, and men were clambering down from the craft itself, one carrying a clipboard, another a length of cable. Mrs. Coulter's eyes gazed at the craft hungrily, memorizing every part of it, making sense of its complexity. And as she watched, Lord Asriel swung himself up into the seat, fastening a leather harness around his waist and shoulders and setting a helmet securely on his head. His demon, the snow leopard, sprang up to follow him, and he turned to adjust something beside her. The engineer called up, Lord Asriel replied, and the men withdrew to the doorway. The intention craft moved, though Mrs. Coulter was not sure how. It was almost as if it had quivered, though there it was, quite still, poised with a strange energy on those six insect legs. As she looked, it moved again, and then she saw what was happening. Various parts of it were revolving, turning this way and that, scanning the dark sky overhead. Lord Asriel sat busily moving this lever, checking that dial, adjusting that control. And then suddenly the intention craft vanished. Somehow it had sprung into the air. It was hovering above them now, as high as a treetop, turning slowly to the left. There was no sound of an engine, no hint of how it was held against gravity. It simply hung in the air.
"Listen to the south."
She turned her head and strained to hear. There was a wind that moaned around the edge of the mountain, and there were the deep hammer blows from the presses which she felt through the soles of her feet, and there was the sound of voices from the lit doorway, but at some signal the voices stopped and the lights were extinguished. And in the quiet Mrs. Coulter could hear, very faintly, the chop-chop-chop of gyropter engines on the gusts of wind.
"Who are they?"
"Decoys,"
said the king.
"My pilots, flying a mission to tempt the enemy to follow. Watch."
She widened her eyes, trying to see anything against the heavy dark with its few stars. Above them, the intention craft hung as firmly as if it were anchored and bolted there. No gust of wind had the slightest effect on it. No light came from the cockpit, so it was very difficult to see, and the figure of Lord Asriel was out of sight completely. Then she caught the first sight of a group of lights low in the sky, at the same moment as the engine sound became loud enough to hear steadily. Six gyropters, flying fast, one of them seemingly in trouble, for smoke trailed from it, and it flew lower than the others. They were making for the mountain, but on a course to take them past it and beyond. And behind them, in close pursuit, came a motley collection of flyers. It was not easy to make out what they were, but Mrs. Coulter saw a heavy gyropter of a strange kind, two straight-winged aircraft, one great bird that glided with effortless speed carrying two armed riders, and three or four angels.
"A raiding party,"
said King Ogunwe. They were closing on the gyropters. Then a line of light blazed from one of the straight-winged aircraft, followed a second or two later by a sound, a deep crack. But the shell never reached its target, the crippled gyropter, because in the same instant as they saw the light, and before they heard the crack, the watchers on the mountain saw a flash from the intention craft, and a shell exploded in midair. Mrs. Coulter had hardly time to understand that almost instantaneous sequence of light and sound before the battle was underway. Nor was it at all easy to follow, because the sky was so dark and the movement of every flyer so quick. But a series of nearly silent flashes lit the mountainside, accompanied by short hisses like the escape of steam. Each flash struck somehow at a different radar. The aircraft caught fire or exploded. The giant bird uttered a scream like the tearing of a mountain-high curtain and plummeted onto the rocks far below. And as for the angels, each of them simply vanished in a drift of glowing air, a myriad particles twinkling and glowing dimmer until they flickered out like a dying firework. Then there was silence. The wind carried away the sound of the decoy gyropters, which had now disappeared around the flank of the mountain, and no one watching spoke. Flames far below glared on the underside of the intention craft, still somehow hovering in the air, and now turning slowly as if to look around. The destruction of the raiding party was so complete that Mrs. Coulter, who had seen many things to be shocked by, was nevertheless shocked by this. As she looked up at the intention craft, it seemed to shimmer or dislodge itself, and then there it was, solidly on the ground again. King Ogunwe hurried forward, as did the other commanders and the engineers, who had thrown open the doors and let the light flood out over the proving ground. Mrs. Coulter stayed where she was, puzzling over the workings of the intention craft.
"Why is he showing it to us?"
her demon said.
"Surely he can't have read our mind."
They were thinking of the moment in the adamant tower when that spark-like idea had flashed between them. They had thought of making Lord Asriel a proposition, of offering to go to the consistorial court of discipline and spy for him. She knew every lever of power. She could manipulate them all. It would be hard at first to convince them of her good faith, but she could do it. And now that the Galivespian spies had left to go with Will and Lyra, surely Asriel couldn't resist an offer like that. But now, as they looked at that strange flying machine, another idea struck even more forcibly. and she hugged the golden monkey with glee.
Azrael, may I see how the machine works?
He looked down, his expression distracted and impatient, but full of excited satisfaction too. He was delighted with the intention craft. She knew he wouldn't be able to resist showing it off. King Ogunwe stood aside, and Lord Asriel reached down and pulled her up into the cockpit. He helped her into the seat and watched as she looked around the controls.
How does it work? What powers it?
Your intentions. Hence the name. If you intend to go forward, it will go forward.
That's no answer. Come on, tell me. What sort of engine is it? How does it fly? I couldn't see anything aerodynamic at all. But these controls, from inside, it's almost like a gyropter.
He was finding it hard not to tell her. And since she was in his power, he did. He held out a cable at the end of which was a leather grip, deeply marked by his demon's teeth.
Your demon has to hold this handle. Whether in teeth or hands, it doesn't matter. And you have to wear that helmet. There's a current flowing between them, and a capacitor amplifies it. Well, it's more complicated than that, but the thing's simple to fly. We put in controls like a gyropter for the sake of familiarity, but eventually we won't need controls at all. Of course, only a human with a demon can fly it.
I see.
And she pushed him hard so that he fell out of the machine. In the same moment, she slipped the helmet on her head, and the golden monkey snatched up the leather handle. She reached for the control that in a gyropter would tilt the aerofoil and pushed the throttle forwards, and at once the intention craft leapt into the air. But she didn't quite have the measure of it yet. The craft hung still for some moments, slightly tilted, before she found the controls to move it forwards. And in those few seconds, Lord Asriel did three things. He leapt to his feet, he put up his hand to stop King Ogunwe from ordering the soldiers to fire on the intention craft, and he said,
Lord Roke, go with her, if you would be so kind.
The Gallivespian urged his blue hawk upwards at once, and the bird flew straight to the still-open cabin door. The watches below could see the woman's head looking this way and that, and the golden monkey likewise, and they could see that neither of them noticed the little figure of Lord Roke leaping from his hawk into the cabin behind them. A moment later, the intention craft began to move, and the hawk wheeled away to skim down to Lord Asriel's wrist. No more than 2 seconds later, the aircraft was already vanishing from sight in the damp and starry air. Lord Asriel watched with rueful admiration.
Well, King, you were quite right, and I should have listened to you in the first place. She is Lyra's mother. I might have expected something like that.
Aren't you going to pursue her?
What, and destroy a perfectly good aircraft? Certainly not.
Where do you think she'll go? In search of the child?
Not at first. She doesn't know where to find her. I know exactly what she'll do. She'll go to the consistorial court and give them the intention craft as an earnest pledge of good faith. And then she'll spy. She'll spy on them for us. She's tried every other kind of duplicity. That one'll be a novel experience. And as soon as she finds out where the girl is, she'll go there, and we shall follow.
And when will Lord Roke let her know he's come with her?
Oh, I think he'll keep that as a surprise, don't you?
They moved back into the workshops, where a later, more advanced model of the intention craft was awaiting their inspection. Chapter 17. Oil and Lacquer.
Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. The Book of Genesis.
Mary Malone was constructing a mirror, not out of vanity, for she had little of that, but because she wanted to test an idea she had. She wanted to try and catch shadows, and without the instruments in her laboratory, she had to improvise with the materials at hand. Molefa technology had little use for metal. They did extraordinary things with stone and wood and cord and shell and horn, but what metals they had were hammered from native nuggets of copper and other metals that they found in the sand of the river, and they were never used for tool-making. They were ornamental. Molefa couples, for example, on entering marriage, would exchange strips of bright copper, which were bent around the base of one of their horns with much the same meaning as a wedding ring. So they were fascinated by the Swiss army knife that was Mary's most valuable possession. Atal, the Zalif who was her particular friend, exclaimed with astonishment one day when Mary unfolded the knife and showed her all the parts, and explained as well as she could, with her limited language, what they were for. One attachment was a miniature magnifying glass, with which she began to burn a design onto a dry branch, and it was that which set her thinking about shadows. They were fishing at the time, but the river was low and the fish must have been elsewhere, So they let the net lie across the water and sat on the grassy bank and talked, until Mary saw the dry branch, which had a smooth white surface. She burned the design, a simple daisy, into the wood, and delighted Atal. But as the thin line of smoke wafted up from the spot where the focused sunlight touched the wood, Mary thought, if this became fossilized, and a scientist in 10 million years found it, they could still find shadows around it, because I've worked on it. She drifted into a sun-doped reverie until Atal asked,
"What are you dreaming?"
Mary tried to explain about her work, her research, the laboratory, the discovery of shadow particles, the fantastical revelation that they were conscious, and found the whole tale gripping her again, so that she longed to be back among her equipment. She didn't expect Atal to follow her explanation, partly because of her own imperfect command of their language, but partly because the Molefa seemed so practical, so strongly rooted in the physical everyday world, and much of what she was saying was mathematical. But Atal surprised her by saying,
"Yes, we know what you mean. We call it..."
And then she used a word that sounded like their word for light. Mary said,
"Light?"
Atal said,
"Not light, but..."
And said the word more slowly for Mary to catch.
"Like the light on water when it makes small ripples at sunset. And the light comes off in bright flakes. We call it that. But it is a make-like."
Make-like was their term for metaphor, Mary had discovered. So she said,
"It is not really light, but you see it, and it looks like that light on water at sunset."
Atal said,
"Yes. All the Molefa have this. You have too. That is how we knew you were like us, and not like the grazers who don't have it. Even though you look so bizarre and horrible, you are like us, because you have..."
And again came that word that Mary couldn't hear quite clearly enough to say, something like sraf or sarf, accompanied by a leftward flick of the trunk. Mary was excited. She had to keep herself calm enough to find the right words.
"What do you know about it? Where does it come from?"
"From us, and from the oil,"
was Atal's reply, and Mary knew she meant the oil in the great seed pod wheels.
"From you?"
"When we have grown up. But without the trees, it would just vanish again. With the wheels and the oil, it stays among us."
"When you have grown up."
Again, Mary had to keep herself from becoming incoherent. One of the things she'd begun to suspect about shadows was that children and adults reacted to them differently, or attracted different kinds of shadow activity. Hadn't Lyra said that the scientists in her world had discovered something like that about dust, which was their name for shadows? Here it was again. And it was connected to what the shadows had said to her on the computer screen, just before she'd left her own world. Whatever it was, this question, it had to do with the great change in human history symbolized in the story of Adam and Eve, with the temptation, the fall, original sin. In his investigations among fossil skulls, her colleague, Oliver Payne, had discovered that around 30,000 years ago, a great increase had taken place in the number of shadow particles associated with human remains. Something had happened then, some development in evolution, to make the human brain an ideal channel for amplifying their effects. She said to Atal,
"How long have there been Molefa?"
And Atal said,
33,000 years.
She was able to read Mary's expressions by this time, or the most obvious of them at least, and she laughed at the way Mary's jaw dropped. The Molefa's laughter was free and joyful and so infectious that Mary usually had to join in, but now she remained serious and astounded and said,
"How can you know so exactly? Do you have a history of all those years?"
"Oh, yes. Ever since we have had the sraf, we have had memory and wakefulness. Before that, we remembered nothing."
"What happened to give you the sraf?"
"We discovered how to use the wheels. One day a creature with no name discovered a seed pod and began to play. And as she played, she..."
"She?"
"She, yes. She had no name before then. She saw a snake coiling itself through the hole in a seed pod, and the snake said...
The snake spoke to her.
No, no, it is a make-like. The story tells that the snake said, What do you know? What do you remember? What do you see ahead? And she said, Nothing, nothing, nothing. So the snake said, Put your foot through the hole in the seed pod where I was playing, and you will become wise. So she put a foot in where the snake had been, and the oil entered her blood and helped her see more clearly than before. And the first thing she saw was the seraph. It was so strange and pleasant that she wanted to share it at once with her kindred. So she and her mate took the seed pods, and they discovered that they knew who they were. They knew they were Mulefa and not grazers. They gave each other names. They named themselves Mulefa. They named the seed tree and all the creatures and plants.
Because they were different.
Yes, they were. And so were their children. Because as more seed pods fell, they showed their children how to use them. And when the children were old enough to ride the wheels, they began to generate the seraph as well. And the seraph came back with the oil and stayed with them. So they saw that they had to plant more seed pod trees for the sake of the oil. But the pods were so hard that they seldom germinated. So the first Mulefa saw what they must do to help the trees, which was to ride on the wheels and break them. So Mulefa and seed pod trees have always lived together.
Mary directly understood about a quarter of what Atal was saying, but by questioning and guessing she found out the rest quite accurately, and her own command of the language was increasing all the time. The more she learned, though, the more difficult it became, as each new thing she found out suggested half a dozen questions, each leading in a different direction. But she pulled her mind after the subject of seraph, because that was the biggest, and that was why she thought about the mirror. It was the comparison of seraph to the sparkles on water that suggested it. Reflected light, like the glare off the sea, was polarized. It might be that the shadow particles, when they behaved like waves, as light did, were capable of being polarized too.
I can't see seraph as you can,
Mary said.
But I would like to make a mirror out of the sap lacquer, because I think that might help me see it.
Atal was excited by this idea, and they hauled in their net at once and began to gather what Mary needed. As a token of good luck, there were three fine fish in the net. The sap lacquer was a product of another and much smaller tree, which the Mulefa cultivated for that purpose. By boiling the sap and dissolving it in the alcohol they made from distilled fruit juice, the Mulefa made a substance like milk in consistency and delicate amber in colour, which they used as a varnish. They would put up to 20 coats on a base of wood or shell, letting each one cure under wet cloth before applying the next, and gradually build up a surface of great hardness and brilliance. They would usually make it opaque with various oxides, but sometimes they left it transparent, and that was what had interested Mary, because the clear, amber-coloured lacquer had the same curious property as the mineral known as Iceland spar. It split light rays in two, so that when you looked through it, you saw double. She wasn't sure what she wanted to do, except that she knew that if she fooled around for long enough, without fretting or nagging herself, she'd find out. She remembered quoting the words of the poet Keats to Lyra, and Lyra's understanding at once that that was her own state of mind when she read the Alethiometer. That was what Mary had to find now. So she began by finding herself a more or less flat piece of a wood like pine, and grinding at the surface with a piece of sandstone, no metal, no planes, until it was as flat as she could make it. That was the method the Mulefa used, and it worked well enough with time and effort. Then she visited the lacquer grove with Atal, having carefully explained what she was intending, and asked permission to take some sap. The Mulefa were happy to let her, but too busy to be concerned. With Atal's help, she drew off some of the sticky, resinous sap, and then came the long process of boiling, dissolving, boiling again, until the varnish was ready to use. The Mulefa used pads of a cottony fibre from another plant to apply it, and following the instructions of a craftsman, she laboriously painted her mirror over and over again, seeing hardly any difference each time as the layer of lacquer was so thin, but letting it cure unhurriedly and finding gradually that the thickness was building up. She painted on over 40 coats, she lost count, but by the time her lacquer had run out, the surface was at least 5 millimeters thick. After the final layer came the polishing, a whole day of rubbing the surface gently in smooth circular movements until her arms ached and her head was throbbing and she could bear the labour no more. Then she slept. Next morning the group went to work in a coppice of what they called knotwood, making sure the shoots were growing as they had been set, tightening the interweaving so that the grown sticks would be properly shaped. They valued Mary's help for this task, as she on her own could squeeze into narrower gaps than the Mulefa, and, with her double hands, work in tighter spaces. It was only when that work was done, and they had returned to the settlement, that Mary could begin to experiment, or rather to play, since she still didn't have a clear idea of what she was doing. First she tried using the lacquer sheet simply as a mirror, but for lack of a silvered back, all she could see was a doubled reflection faintly in the wood. Then she thought that what she really needed was the lacquer without the wood, but she quailed at the idea of making another sheet. How could she make it flat without a backing anyway? The idea came of simply cutting the wood away to leave the lacquer. That would take time too, but at least she had the Swiss Army knife. And she began, splitting it very delicately from the edge, taking the greatest of care not to scratch the lacquer from behind, but eventually removing most of the pine and leaving a mess of torn and splintered wood stuck immovably to the pane of clear, hard varnish. She wondered what would happen if she soaked it in water. Did the lacquer soften if it got wet?
No,
said her master in the craft.
It will remain hard forever. But why not do it like this?
And he showed her a liquid kept in a stone bowl, which would eat through any wood in only a few hours. It looked and smelled to Mary like an acid. That would hurt the lacquer hardly at all, he said, and she could repair any damage easily enough. He was intrigued by her project and helped her to swab the acid delicately onto the wood, telling her how they made it by grinding and dissolving and distilling a mineral they found at the edge of some shallow lakes she had not yet visited. Gradually the wood softened and came free, and Mary was left with a single sheet of clear brown-yellow lacquer, about the size of a page from a paperback book. She polished the reverse as highly as the top, until both were as flat and smooth as the finest mirror, and when she looked through it, nothing in particular. It was perfectly clear, but it showed her a double image, the right one quite close to the left and about 15 degrees upwards. She wondered what would happen if she looked through two pieces, one on top of the other. So she took the Swiss Army knife again and tried to score a line across the sheet so she could cut it in two. By working and reworking and by keeping the knife sharp on a smooth stone, she managed to score a line deep enough for her to risk snapping the sheet. She laid a thin stick under the score line and pushed sharply down on the lacquer, as she'd seen a glazier cutting glass, and it worked. Now she had two sheets. She put them together and looked through. The amber colour was denser, and like a photographic filter it emphasised some colours and held back others, giving a slightly different cast to the landscape. The curious thing was that the doubleness had disappeared, and everything was single again, but there was no sign of shadows. She moved the two pieces apart, watching how the appearance of things changed as she did so. When they were about a hand span apart, a curious thing happened. The amber colouring disappeared, and everything seemed its normal colour, but brighter and more vivid. At that point, Atal came along to see what she was doing.
Can you see Sraf now?
No, but I can see other things,
Mary said, and tried to show her. Atal was interested, but politely, not with the sense of discovery that was animating Mary. And presently the Zalif tired of looking through the small pieces of lacquer and settled down on the grass to maintain her wheels and claws. Sometimes the Mulefa would groom each other's claws out of pure sociability, and once or twice Atal had invited Mary to attend to hers. Mary, in turn, let Atal tidy her hair, enjoying how the soft trunk lifted it and let it fall, stroking and massaging her scalp. She sensed that Atal wanted this now, so she put down the two pieces of lacquer and ran her hands over the astonishing smoothness of Atal's claws, that surface smoother and slicker than Teflon that rested on the lower rim of the central hole and served as a bearing when the wheel turned. The contours matched exactly, of course, and as Mary ran her hands around the inside of the wheel, she could feel no difference in texture It was as if the Mulefa and the seed pod really were one creature, which by a miracle could disassemble itself and put itself together again. Atal was soothed, and so was Mary by this contact. Her friend was young and unmarried, and there were no young males in this group, so she would have to marry a Zalif from outside. But contact wasn't easy, and sometimes Mary thought that Atal was anxious about her future. So she didn't begrudge the time she spent with her, and now she was happy to clean the wheel holes of all the dust and grime that accumulated there, and smooth the fragrant oil gently over her friend's claws while Atal's trunk lifted and straightened her hair. When Atal had had enough, she set herself on the wheels again and moved away to help with the evening meal. Mary turned back to her lacquer, and almost at once she made her discovery. She held the two plates a hand-span apart so that they showed that clear, bright image she'd seen before, but something had happened. As she looked through, she saw a swarm of golden sparkles surrounding the form of Atal. They were only visible through one small part of the lacquer, and then Mary realized why. At that point she had touched the surface of it with her oily fingers.
Atal! Quick! Come back!
Atal turned and wheeled back.
Let me take a little oil, just enough to put on the lacquer.
Atal willingly let her run her fingers around the wheel holes again, and watched curiously as Mary coated one of the pieces with a film of the clear, sweet substance. Then she pressed the plates together and moved them around to spread the oil evenly, and held them a hand span apart once more. And when she looked through, everything was changed. She could see shadows. If she'd been in the Jordan College retiring room, when Lord Asriel had projected the photograms he'd made with the special emulsion, she would have recognized the effect. Everywhere she looked, she could see gold, just as Atal had described it. Sparkles of light, floating and drifting and sometimes moving in a current of purpose. Among it all was the world she could see with the naked eye, the grass, the river, the trees, but wherever she saw a conscious being, one of the Mulefa, the light was thicker and more full of movement. It didn't obscure their shapes in any way. If anything, it made them clearer.
I didn't know it was beautiful,
Mary said to Atal.
Why, of course it is,
her friend replied.
It is strange to think that you couldn't see it. Look at the little one.
Atal indicated one of the small children playing in the long grass, leaping clumsily after grasshoppers, suddenly stopping to examine a leaf, falling over, scrambling up again to rush and tell his mother something, being distracted again by a piece of stick, trying to pick it up, finding ants on his trunk and hooting with agitation. There was a golden haze around him, as there was around the shelters, the fishing nets, the evening fire, stronger than theirs, though not by much. But unlike theirs, it was full of little swirling currents of intention that eddied and broke off and drifted about, to disappear as new ones were born. Around his mother, on the other hand, the golden sparkles were much stronger, and the currents they moved in were more settled and powerful. She was preparing food, spreading flour on a flat stone, making the thin bread like chapatis or tortillas, watching her child at the same time, and the shadows, or the sraf, or the dust, that bathed her, looked like the very image of responsibility and wise care.
So at last you can see. Well, now you must come with me.
Mary looked at her friend in puzzlement. Atal's tone was strange. It was as if she were saying, finally you're ready. We've been waiting. Now things must change. And others were appearing, from over the brow of the hill, from out of their shelters, from along the river. Members of the group, but strangers too, Mulefa, who were new to her, and who looked curiously towards where she was standing. The sound of their wheels on the hard-packed earth was low and steady.
Where must I go?
Mary said.
Why are they all coming here?
Don't worry,
said Atal.
Come with me. We shall not hurt you.
It seemed to have been long planned, this meeting, for they all knew where to go and what to expect. There was a low mound at the edge of the village that was regular in shape and packed with hard earth, with ramps at each end, and the crowd, 50 or so at least, Mary estimated, was moving towards it. The smoke of the cooking fires hung in the evening air, and the setting sun spread its own kind of hazy gold over everything. Mary was aware of the smell of roasting corn and the warm smell of the muléfa themselves, part oil, part warm flesh, a sweet, horse-like smell. Atal urged her towards the mound. Mary said,
"What is happening? Tell me."
"No, no, not me. Satamax will speak."
Mary didn't know the name Satamax, and the Zalif whom Atal indicated was a stranger to her. He was older than anyone she'd seen so far. At the base of his trunk was a scatter of white hairs, and he moved stiffly as if he had arthritis. The others all moved with care around him, and when Mary stole a glance through the lacquer glass, she saw why. The old Zalif's shadow cloud was so rich and complex that Mary herself felt respect, even though she knew so little of what it meant. When Satamax was ready to speak, the rest of the crowd fell silent. Mary stood close to the mound, with Atal nearby for reassurance. But she sensed all their eyes on her and felt as if she were a new girl at school. Satamax began to speak. His voice was deep, the tones rich and varied, the gestures of his trunk low and graceful.
"We have all come together to greet the stranger, Mary. Those of us who know her have reason to be grateful for her activities since she arrived among us. We have waited until she had some command of our language. With the help of many of us, but especially the Zalif Atal, the stranger Mary can now understand us. But there was another thing she had to understand, and that was Shraf. She knew about it, but she could not see it as we can until she made an instrument to look through. And now she has succeeded. She is ready to learn more about what she must do to help us. Mary, come here and join me."
Mary felt dizzy, self-conscious, bemused, but she did as she had to and stepped up beside the old Zalif. She thought she had better speak, so she began.
"You have all made me feel I am a friend. You are kind and hospitable. I came from a world where life is very different, but some of us are aware of Sraf, as you are, and I'm grateful for your help in making this glass through which I can see it. If there is any way in which I can help you, I will be glad to do it."
She spoke more awkwardly than she did with Atal, and she was afraid she hadn't made her meaning clear. It was hard to know where to face when you had to gesture as well as speak, but they seemed to understand. Satamax said,
"It is good to hear you speak. We hope you will be able to help us. If not, I cannot see how we will survive. The Tualapi will kill us all. There are more of them than there ever were, and their numbers are increasing every year. Something has gone wrong with the world. For most of the 33,000 years that there have been Muléfa, we have taken care of the earth. Everything balanced. The trees prospered, the grazers were healthy, and even if once in a while the Tualapi came, our numbers and theirs remained constant. But 300 years ago, the trees began to sicken. We watched them anxiously and tended them with care, and still we found them producing fewer seed pods and dropping their leaves out of season, and some of them died outright, which had never been known. All our memory could not find a cause for this. To be sure, the process was slow, but so is the rhythm of our lives. We did not know that until you came. We have seen butterflies and birds, but they have no Sraf. You do. Strange as you seem, but you are swift and immediate, like birds, like butterflies. You realize there is a need for something to help you see Sraf. And instantly, out of the materials we have known for thousands of years, you put together an instrument to do so. Beside us, you think and act with the speed of a bird. That is how it seems, which is how we know that our rhythm seems slow to you. But that fact is our hope. You can see things that we cannot. You can see connections and possibilities and alternatives that are invisible to us, just as Sraf was invisible to you. And while we cannot see a way to survive, we hope that you may. We hope that you will go swiftly to the cause of the tree's sickness and find a cure. We hope you will invent a means of dealing with the Tualapi, who are so numerous and so powerful. And we hope you can do so soon, or we shall all die.
There was a murmur of agreement and approval from the crowd. They were all looking at Mary, and she felt more than ever like the new pupil at a school where they had high expectations of her. She also felt a strange flattery. The idea of herself as swift and darting and bird-like was new and pleasant, because she had always thought of herself as dogged and plodding. But along with that came the feeling that they'd got it terribly wrong if they saw her like that. They didn't understand at all. She couldn't possibly fulfill this desperate hope of theirs. But equally, she must. They were waiting.
Satamax, Mulefa, you put your trust in me, and I shall do my best. You have been kind, and your life is good and beautiful, and I will try very hard to help you. And now I have seen Sraf, I know what it is that I'm doing. Thank you for trusting me.
They nodded and murmured and stroked her with their trunks as she stepped down. She was daunted by what she had agreed to do. At that very moment in the world of Chitagatse, the assassin priest Father Gomez was making his way up a rough track in the mountains between the twisted trunks of olive trees. The evening light slanted through the silvery leaves, and the air was full of the noise of crickets and cicadas. Ahead of him he could see a little farmhouse sheltered among vines, where a goat bleated and a spring trickled down through the grey rocks. There was an old man attending to some task beside the house, and an old woman leading the goat towards a stool and a bucket. In the village, some way behind, they had told him that the woman he was following had passed this way, and that she talked of going up into the mountains. Perhaps this old couple had seen her. At least there might be cheese and olives to buy and spring water to drink. Father Gomez was quite used to living frugally, and there was plenty of time. Chapter 18. The Suburbs of the Dead.
Oh, that it were possible we might but hold some 2 days' conference with the dead. John Webster.
Lyra was awake before dawn, with Pantalaimon shivering at her breast, and she got up to walk about and warm herself up as the grey light seeped into the sky. She had never known such silence, not even in the snow-blanketed Arctic. There was not a stir of wind, and the sea was so still that not the tiniest ripple broke on the sand. The world seemed suspended between breathing in and breathing out. Will lay curled up fast asleep, with his head on the rucksack to protect the knife. The cloak had fallen off his shoulder, and she tucked it around him, pretending that she was taking care to avoid his demon, and that she had the form of a cat curled up just as he was. She must be here somewhere, Lyra thought. Carrying the still sleepy Pantalaimon, she walked away from Will and sat down on the slope of a sand dune a little way off, so their voices wouldn't wake him.
Those little people,
Pantalaimon said.
I don't like 'em. I think we should get away from him as soon as we can. I reckon if we trap him in a net or something, Will can cut through and close up, and that's it. We'll be free.
We haven't got a net or something. Anyway, I bet they're cleverer than that. He's watching us now.
Pantalaimon was a hawk as he said that, and his eyes were keener than hers. The darkness of the sky was turning minute by minute into the palest ethereal blue, and as she looked across the sand, the first edge of the sun just cleared the rim of the sea, dazzling her. Because she was on the slope of the dune, the light reached her a few seconds before it touched the beach, and she watched it flow around her and along towards Will. And then she saw the hand-high figure of the Chevalier Tialis, standing by Will's head, clear and wide awake, and watching them.
The thing is, they can't make us do what they want. They got to follow us. I bet they're fed up.
If they got hold of us,
said Pantalaimon, meaning him and Lyra,
and got their stings ready to stick in us, Will'd have to do what they said.
Lyra thought about it. She remembered vividly the horrible scream of pain from Mrs. Coulter, the eye-rolling convulsions, the ghastly lolling drool of the golden monkey as the poison entered her bloodstream. And that was only a scratch, as her mother had recently been reminded elsewhere. Will would have to give in and do what they wanted.
Suppose they thought he wouldn't, though. Suppose they thought he was so cold-hearted he'd just watch us die. Maybe he better make them think that, if he can.
She had brought the alethiometer with her, and now that it was light enough to see, she took the beloved instrument out and laid it on its black velvet cloth in her lap. Little by little, Lyra drifted into that trance in which the many layers of meaning were clear to her, and where she could sense intricate webs of connectedness between them all. As her fingers found the symbols, her mind found the words, "How can we get rid of the spies?" Then the needle began to dart this way and that, almost too fast to see, and some part of Lyra's awareness counted the swings and the stops and saw at once the meaning of what the movement said. It told her, "Do not try, because your lives depend on them." That was a surprise and not a happy one. But she went on and asked, "How can we get to the land of the dead?" The answer came, "Go down. Follow the knife. Go onwards. Follow the knife." And finally she asked hesitantly, half ashamed, "Is this the right thing to do?" "Yes," said the alethiometer instantly. "Yes." She sighed, coming out of her trance, and tucked the hair behind her ears, feeling the first warmth of the sun on her face and shoulders. There were sounds in the world now, too. Insects were stirring, and a very slight breeze was rustling the dry grass stems growing higher up the dune. She put the alethiometer away and wandered back to Will, with Pantalaimon as large as he could make himself, and lion-shaped, in the hope of daunting the Gallivespians. The man was using his lodestone apparatus, and when he'd finished, Lyra said,
"You've been talking to Lord Asriel?"
"To his representative,"
said Tialis.
"We ain't going."
"That's what I told him."
"What did he say?"
"That was for my ears, not yours."
"Suit yourself. Are you married to that lady?"
"No. We are colleagues."
"Have you got any children?"
"No."
Tialis continued to pack the lodestone resonator away, and as he did so, the Lady Salmakia woke up nearby, sitting up graceful and slow from the little hollow she'd made in the soft sand. The dragonflies were still asleep, tethered with cobweb-thin cord, their wings damp with dew.
"Are there big people on your world, or are they all small like you?"
"We know how to deal with big people,"
Tialis replied, not very helpfully, and went to talk quietly to the lady. They spoke too softly for Lyra to hear, but she enjoyed watching them sip dewdrops from the marum grass to refresh themselves. Water must be different for them, she thought to Pantalaimon. Imagine drops the size of your fist. They'd be hard to get into. They'd have a sort of elastic rind, like a balloon. By this time, Will was waking too, wearily. The first thing he did was to look for the Gallivespians, who looked back at once, fully focused on him. He looked away and found Lyra.
"I want to tell you something,"
she said.
"Come over here, away from..."
"If you go away from us, you must leave the knife. If you won't leave the knife, you must talk to each other here."
"Can't we be private? We don't want you listening to what we say."
"Then go away, but leave the knife."
There was no one else nearby, after all, and certainly the Gallivespians wouldn't be able to use it. Will rummaged in the rucksack for the water bottle and a couple of biscuits, and handing one to Lyra, he went with her up the slope of the dune.
I asked the alethiometer, and it said we shouldn't try and escape from the little people because they were going to save our lives. So maybe we're stuck with them.
Have you told them what we're going to do?
No, and I won't either. Because they'll only tell Lord Asriel on that speaking fiddle, and he'd go there and stop us. So we got to just go and not talk about it in front of them.
They are spies, though. They must be good at listening and hiding. So maybe we better not mention it at all. We know where we're going, so we'll just go and not talk about it. And they'll have to put up with it and come along.
They can't hear us now. They're too far off. Will, I asked how we get there too. It said to follow the knife. Just that.
Sounds easy, but I bet it isn't. Do you know what Yorick told me?
No. He said, when I went to say goodbye, he said it would be very difficult for you. But he thought you could do it. But he never told me why.
The knife broke because I thought of my mother. So, I've got to put her out of my mind. But it's like when someone says, don't think about a crocodile. You do. You can't help it.
Well, you cut through last night, all right.
Yeah, because I was tired, I think. Well, we'll see. Just follow the knife.
That's all it said.
Might as well go now, then. Except there's not much food left. We ought to find something to take with us. Bread and fruit or something. So first I'll find a world where we can get food, and then we'll start looking properly.
All right,
said Lyra, quite happy to be moving again, with Pan and Will alive and awake. They made their way back to the spies, who were sitting alertly by the knife, packs on their backs.
We should like to know what you intend,
said Selmakia.
Well, we're not coming to Lord Asriel anyway,
said Will.
We've got something else to do first.
And will you tell us what that is, since it's clear we can't stop you from doing it?
No, because you just go and tell them. You'll have to come along without knowing where we're going. Of course, you could always give up and go back to them.
Certainly not,
said Tialis.
We want some kind of guarantee. You're spies, so you're bound to be dishonest. That's your trade. We need to know we can trust you. Last night we were all too tired and we couldn't think about it. But there'd be nothing to stop you waiting till we were asleep and then stinging us to make us helpless and calling up Lord Asriel on that lodestone thing. You could do that easily. So we need to have a proper guarantee that you won't. A promise isn't enough.
The two Gallivespians trembled with anger at this slur on their honour. Tialis, controlling himself, said,
We don't accept one-sided demands. You must give something in exchange. You must tell us what your intentions are. And then I shall give the lodestone resonator into your care. You must let me have it when I want to send a message, but you will always know when that happens, and we shall not be able to use it without your agreement. That will be our guarantee. And now you tell us where you are going and why.
Will and Lyra exchanged a glance to confirm it.
All right, that's fair. So here's where we're going. We're going to the world of the dead. We don't know where it is, but the knife will find it. That's what we're going to do.
The two spies were looking at her with open-mouthed incredulity. Then Selmakia blinked and said,
What you say doesn't make sense. The dead are dead, that's all. There is no world of the dead.
I thought that was true as well, but now I'm not sure. At least with the knife we can find out.
But why?
Lyra looked at Will and saw him nod.
Well, before I met Will, long before I was asleep, I led this friend into danger, and he was killed. I thought I was rescuing him, only I was making things worse. And while I was asleep, I dreamed of him, and I thought maybe I could make amends if I went where he's gone and said I was sorry. And Will wants to find his father, who died just when he found him before. See, Lord Asriel wouldn't think of that, nor would Mrs. Coulter. If we went to him, we'd have to do what he wants, and he wouldn't think of Roger at all. That's my friend who died. It wouldn't matter to him, but it matters to me, to us. So that's what we want to do.
Child, when we die, everything is over. There is no other life. You have seen death, you've seen dead bodies, and you've seen what happens to a demon when death comes.
It vanishes. What else can there be to live on after that?
We're going to go and find out. And now we've told you, I'll take your resonator lodestone.
She held out her hand, and Leopard Pantalaimon stood, tail swinging slowly, to reinforce her demand. Tialis unslung the pack from his back and laid it in her palm. It was surprisingly heavy. No burden for her, of course, but she marvelled at his strength.
"And how long do you think this expedition will take?"
said the Chevalier.
"We don't know. We don't know anything about it, any more than you do. We'll just go there and see."
"First thing, we've got to get some water and some more food, something easy to carry. So I'm going to find a world where we can do that, and then we'll set off."
Tialis and Salmakia mounted their dragonflies and held them quivering on the ground. The great insects were eager for flight, but the command of their riders was absolute, and Lyra, watching them in daylight for the first time, saw the extraordinary fineness of the grey silk reins, the silvery stirrups, the tiny saddles. Will took the knife, and a powerful temptation made him feel for the touch of his own world. He had the credit card still. He could buy familiar food. He could even telephone Mrs. Cooper and ask for news of his mother. The knife jarred with a sound like a nail being drawn along rough stone, and his heart nearly stopped. If he broke the blade again, it would be the end. After a few moments, he tried again. Instead of trying not to think of his mother, he said to himself, "Yes, I know she's there, but I'm just going to look away while I do this." And that time it worked. He found a new world and slid the knife along to make an opening, and a few moments later all of them were standing in what looked like a neat and prosperous farmyard in some northern country like Holland or Denmark, where the stone-flagged yard was swept and clean and a row of stable doors stood open. The sun shone down through a hazy sky, and there was the smell of burning in the air, as well as something less pleasant. There was no sound of human life, though a loud buzzing, so active and vigorous that it sounded like a machine, came from the stables. Lyra went and looked, and came back at once, looking pale.
"There's four..."
She gulped, hand to her throat, and recovered.
"Four dead horses in there, and millions of flies."
"Look, or maybe better not."
He was pointing at the raspberry canes that edged the kitchen garden. He'd just seen a man's legs, one with a shoe on and one without, protruding from the thickest part of the bushes. Lyra didn't want to look, but Will went to see if the man was still alive and needed help. He came back, shaking his head, looking uneasy. The two spies were already at the farmhouse door, which was ajar. Tialis darted back and said,
"It smells sweeter in there."
And then he flew back over the threshold while Salmakia scouted further around the outbuildings. Will followed the Chevalier. He found himself in a big square kitchen, an old-fashioned place with white china on a wooden dresser and a scrubbed pine table, and a hearth where a black kettle stood cold. Next door there was a pantry, with two shelves full of apples that filled the whole room with fragrance. The silence was oppressive.
"Will, is this the world of the dead?"
The same thought had occurred to him, but he said,
"No, I don't think so. It's one we haven't been in before. Look, we'll load up with as much as we can carry. There's sort of rye bread. That'll be good. It's light. And here's some cheese."
When they had taken what they could carry, Will dropped a gold coin into the drawer in the big pine table.
"Well,"
said Lyra, seeing Tialis raise his eyebrows,
"you should always pay for what you take."
At that moment, Salmakia came in through the back door, landing her dragonfly on the table in a shimmer of electric blue.
"There are men coming, on foot, with weapons. They're only a few minutes' walk away, and there is a village burning beyond the fields."
And as she spoke, they could hear the sound of boots on gravel and a voice issuing orders and the jingle of metal.
"Then we should go,"
said Will. He felt in the air with the knife point, and at once he was aware of a new kind of sensation. The blade seemed to be sliding along a very smooth surface like a mirror, and then it sank through slowly until he was able to cut. But it was resistant, like heavy cloth, and when he made an opening he blinked with surprise and alarm, because the world he was opening into was the same in every detail as the one they were already standing in.
"What's happening?"
said Lyra. The spies were looking through, puzzled, but it was more than puzzlement they felt. Just as the air had resisted the knife, so something in this opening resisted their going through. Will had to push against something invisible, and then pull Lyra after him, and the Gallivespians could hardly make any headway at all. They had to perch the dragonflies on the children's hands, and even then it was like pulling them against a pressure in the air. Their filmy wings bent and twisted, and the little riders had to stroke their mounts' heads and whisper to calm their fears. But after a few seconds of struggle, they were all through, and Will found the edge of the window, though it was impossible to see, and closed it, shutting the sound of the soldiers away in their own world.
"Will,"
said Lyra, and he turned to see that there was another figure in the kitchen with them. His heart jolted. It was the man he'd seen not 10 minutes before, stark dead in the bushes with his throat cut. He was middle-aged, lean, with the look of a man who spent most of the time in the open air. But now he was looking almost crazed or paralyzed with shock. His eyes were so wide that the white showed all around the iris, and he was clutching the edge of the table with a trembling hand. His throat, Will was glad to see, was intact. He opened his mouth to speak, but no words came out. All he could do was point at Will and Lyra.
"Excuse us for being in your house, but we had to escape from the men who were coming. I'm sorry if we startled you. I'm Lyra, and this is Will. And these are our friends, the Chevalier Tialis and the Lady Salmakia. Could you tell us your name and where we are?"
This normal-sounding request seemed to bring the man to his senses, and a shudder passed over him, as if he were waking from a dream.
"I'm dead. I'm lying out there dead. I know I am. You ain't dead. What's happening? God help me. They cut my throat. What's happening?"
Lyra stepped closer to Will when the man said, "I'm dead," and Pantalaimon fled to her breast as a mouse. As for the Gallivespians, they were trying to control their dragonflies, because the great insects seemed to have an aversion for the man and darted here and there in the kitchen, looking for a way out. But the man didn't notice them. He was still trying to understand what had happened.
"Are you a ghost?"
The man reached out his hand, and Will tried to take it, but his fingers closed on the air. A tingle of cold was all he felt. When he saw it happen, the man looked at his own hand, appalled. The numbness was beginning to wear off, and he could feel the pity of his state.
"Truly, I am dead. I'm dead, and I'm going to hell."
"Hush, we'll go together. What's your name?"
Dirk Jensen I was. But already I don't know what to do. Don't know where to go."
Will opened the door. The barnyard looked the same. The kitchen garden was unchanged. The same hazy sun shone down. And there was the man's body, untouched. A little groan broke from Dirk Jansen's throat, as if there were no denying it any more. The dragonflies darted out of the door and skimmed over the ground and then shot up high, faster than birds. The man was looking around helplessly, raising his hands, lowering them again, uttering little cries.
"I can't stay here. Can't stay. But this ain't the farm I knew. This is wrong. I got to go."
"Oh, where are you going, Mr. Jansen?"
"Down the road. Don't know. Got to go. Can't stay here."
Salmakia flew down to perch on Lyra's hand. The dragonfly's little claws pricked as the lady said,
"There are people walking from the village. People like this man, all walking in the same direction."
"Then we'll go with them,"
said Will, and swung his rucksack over his shoulder. Dirk Jansen was already passing his own body, averting his eyes. He looked almost as if he were drunk, stopping, moving on, wandering to left and right, stumbling over little ruts and stones on the path his living feet had known so well. Lyra came after Will, and Pantalaimon became a kestrel and flew up as high as he could, making Lyra gasp.
"They're right,"
he said when he came down.
"There's lines of people all coming from the village. Dead people."
And soon they saw them too. 20 or so men, women and children, all moving as Dirk Jansen had done, uncertain and shocked. The village was half a mile away, and the people were coming towards them, close together in the middle of the road. When Dirk Jansen saw the other ghosts, he broke into a stumbling run, and they held out their hands to greet him.
"Even if they don't know where they're going, they're all going there together. We better just go with them."
"Do you think they had demons in this world?"
"Can't tell. If you saw one of them in your world, would you know he was a ghost?
It's hard to say. They don't look normal exactly. There was a man I used to see in my town, and he used to walk about outside the shops always holding the same old plastic bag. And he never spoke to anyone nor went inside, and no one ever looked at him. I used to pretend he was a ghost. They look a bit like him. Maybe my world's full of ghosts, and I never knew.
I don't think mine is.
Anyway, this must be the world of the dead. These people have just been killed. Those soldiers must have done it. And here they are. And it's just like the world they were alive in. I thought it'd be a lot different.
Will, it's fading. Look.
She was clutching his arm. He stopped and looked around, and she was right. Not long before he had found the window in Oxford and stepped through into the other world of Chitagatse, there had been an eclipse of the sun. And like millions of others, Will had stood outside at midday and watched as the bright daylight faded and dimmed until a sort of eerie twilight covered the houses, the trees, the park. Everything was just as clear as in full daylight, but there was less light to see it by, as if all the strength were draining out of a dying sun. What was happening now was like that, but odder, because the edges of things were losing their definition as well and becoming blurred.
It's not like going blind, even, because it's not that we can't see things. It's like the things themselves are fading.
The colour was slowly seeping out of the world. A dim green-grey for the bright green of the trees and the grass. A dim sand-grey for the vivid yellow of a field of corn. A dim blood-grey for the red bricks of a neat farmhouse. The people themselves, closer now, had begun to notice, too, and were pointing and holding one another's arms for reassurance. The only bright things in the whole landscape were the brilliant red and yellow and electric blue of the dragonflies, and their little riders, and Will and Lyra, and Pantalaimon, who was hovering kestrel-shaped close above. They were close to the first of the people now, and it was clear they were all ghosts. Will and Lyra took a step towards each other, but there was nothing to fear, for the ghosts were far more afraid of them and were hanging back, unwilling to approach. Will called out,
"Don't be afraid. We're not going to hurt you. Where are you going?"
They looked at the oldest man among them, as if he were their guide.
"We're going where all the others go. Seems as if I know, but I can't remember learning it. Seems as if it's along the road. We'll know it when we get there."
"Mama,"
said a child.
"Why is it getting dark in the daytime?"
"Hush, dear, don't fret,"
the mother said.
"Can't make anything better by fretting. We're dead, I expect."
"But where are we going? I don't want to be dead, Mama."
"We're going to see Grandpa."
But the child wouldn't be consoled and wept bitterly. Others in the group looked at the mother with sympathy or annoyance, but there was nothing they could do to help, and they all walked on disconsolately through the fading landscape as the child's thin cries went on and on and on. The Chevalier Tialis had spoken to Salmakia before skimming ahead, and Will and Lyra watched the dragonfly with eyes greedy for its brightness and vigour as it got smaller and smaller. The lady flew down and perched her insect on Will's hand.
"The Chevalier has gone to see what's ahead,"
she said.
"We think the landscape is fading because these people are forgetting it. The farther they go away from their homes, the darker it will get."
"But why do you think they're moving? If I was a ghost, I'd want to stay in the places I knew, not wander along and get lost."
"They feel unhappy there,"
Will said, guessing.
"It's where they've just died. They're afraid of it."
"No, they're pulled onward by something. Some instinct is drawing them down the road."
And indeed, the ghosts were moving more purposefully now that they were out of sight of their own village. The sky was as dark as if a mighty storm were threatening, but there was none of the electric tension that comes ahead of a storm. The ghosts walked on steadily, and the road ran straight ahead across a landscape that was almost featureless. From time to time, one of them would glance at Will or Lyra, or at the brilliant dragonfly and its rider, as if they were curious. Finally, the oldest man said,
"You, you boy and girl, you ain't dead. You ain't ghosts. What are you coming along here for?"
"We came through by accident,"
Lyra told him before Will could speak.
"I don't know how it happened. We were trying to escape from those men, and we just seemed to find ourselves here."
"How will you know when you've got to the place where you've got to go?"
"I expect we'll be told. They'll separate out the sinners and the righteous, I dare say. It's no good praying now. It's too late for that. You should have done that when you were alive. No use now.
It was quite clear which group he expected to be in, and quite clear, too, that he thought it wouldn't be a big one. The other ghosts heard him uneasily, but he was all the guidance they had, so they followed without arguing. And on they walked, trudging in silence under a sky that had finally darkened to a dull iron grey, and remained there without getting any darker. The living ones found themselves looking to their left and right, above and below, for anything that was bright or lively or joyful, and they were always disappointed until a little spark appeared ahead and raced towards them through the air. It was the Chevalier, and Salmakia urged her dragonfly ahead to meet him, with a cry of pleasure. They conferred and sped back to the children.
"There's a town ahead,"
said Dialis.
"It looks like a refugee camp, but it's obviously been there for centuries or more. And I think there's a sea or a lake beyond it, but that's covered in mist. I could hear the cries of birds. And there are hundreds of people arriving every minute from every direction. People like these ghosts."
The ghosts themselves listened as he spoke, though without much curiosity. They seemed to have settled into a dull trance, and Lyra wanted to shake them, to urge them to struggle and wake up and look around for a way out.
"How are we going to help these people, Will?"
He couldn't even guess. As they moved on, they could see a movement on the horizon to the left and right, and ahead of them a dirty-coloured smoke was rising slowly to add its darkness to the dismal air. The movement was people or ghosts. In lines or pairs or groups or alone, but all empty-handed, hundreds and thousands of men and women and children were drifting over the plain towards the source of the smoke. The ground was sloping downwards now and becoming more and more like a rubbish dump. The air was heavy and full of smoke, and of other smells besides. Acrid chemicals, decaying vegetable matter, sewage. And the further down they went, the worse it got. There was not a patch of clean soil in sight, and the only plants growing anywhere were rank weeds and coarse greyish grass. Ahead of them, above the water, was the mist. It rose like a cliff to merge with the gloomy sky, and from somewhere inside it came those bird cries that Tialis had referred to. Between the waste heaps and the mist, there lay the first town of the dead. Chapter 19. Lyra and Her Death.
I was angry with my friend. I told my wrath. My wrath did end. William Blake.
Here and there, fires had been lit among the ruins. The town was a jumble, with no streets, no squares, and no open spaces except where a building had fallen. A few churches or public buildings still stood above the rest, though their roofs were holed or their walls cracked, and in one case a whole portico had crumbled onto its columns. Between the shells of the stone buildings, a mazy clutter of shacks and shanties had been put together out of lengths of roofing timber, beaten-out petrol cans or biscuit tins, torn plastic sheeting, scraps of plywood or hardboard. The ghosts who had come with them were hurrying towards the town, and from every direction came more of them, so many that they looked like the grains of sand that trickled towards the hole of an hourglass. The ghosts walked straight into the squalid confusion of the town, as if they knew exactly where they were going, and Lyra and Will were about to follow them. But then they were stopped. A figure stepped out of a patched-up doorway and said,
"Wait, wait."
A dim light was glowing behind him, and it wasn't easy to make out his features. But they knew he wasn't a ghost. He was like them, alive. He was a thin man who could have been any age, dressed in a drab and tattered business suit, and he was holding a pencil and a sheaf of papers held together with a clip. The building he'd stepped out of had the look of a customs post on a rarely visited frontier.
"What is this place?"
said Will.
"And why can't we go in?"
"You're not dead. You have to wait in the holding area. Go farther along the road to the left and give these papers to the official at the gate."
"But excuse me, sir. I hope you don't mind me asking. But how can we have come this far if we ain't dead? Because this is the world of the dead, isn't it?"
"It's a suburb of the world of the dead. Sometimes the living come here by mistake, but they have to wait in the holding area before they can go on."
"Wait for how long?"
until they die.
Will felt his head swim. He could see Lyra was about to argue, and before she could speak, he said,
Can you just explain what happens then? I mean, these ghosts who come here, do they stay in this town forever?
No, no. This is just a port of transit. They go on beyond here by boat.
Where to?
That's not something I can tell you,
said the man, and a bitter smile pulled his mouth down at the corners.
You must move along, please. You must go to the holding area.
Will took the papers the man was holding out, and then held Lyra's arm and urged her away. The dragonflies were flying sluggishly now, and Tialis explained that they needed to rest. So they perched on Will's rucksack, and Lyra let the spies sit on her shoulders. Pantalaimon, leopard-shaped, looked up at them jealously, but he said nothing. They moved along the track, skirting the wretched shanties and the pools of sewage, and watching the never-ending stream of ghosts arriving and passing without hindrance into the town itself.
We've got to get over the water, like the rest of them, and maybe the people in this holding place will tell us how. They don't seem to be angry anyway, or dangerous. It's strange. And these papers...
They were simply scraps of paper torn from a notebook, with random words scribbled in pencil and crossed out. It was as if these people were playing a game and waiting to see when the travellers would challenge them or give in and laugh. And yet it all looked so real. It was getting darker and colder, and time was hard to keep track of. Lyra thought they walked for half an hour, or maybe it was twice as long. The look of the place didn't change. Finally, they reached a little wooden shack like the one they'd stopped at earlier, where a dim bulb glowed on a bare wire over the door. As they approached, a man dressed much like the other one came out, holding a piece of bread and butter in one hand, and without a word, looked at their papers and nodded. He handed them back and was about to go inside when Will said,
Excuse me, where do we go now?
Go and find somewhere to stay. Just ask. Everybody's waiting, same as you.
He turned away and shut his door against the cold, and the travellers turned down into the heart of the shanty town, where the living people had to stay. It was very much like the main town, shabby little huts, repaired a dozen times, patched with scraps of plastic or corrugated iron, leaning crazily against each other over muddy alleyways. At some places, an anbaric cable looped down from a bracket and provided enough feeble current to power a naked light bulb or two strung out over the nearby huts. Most of what light there was, however, came from the fires. Their smoky glow flickered redly over the scraps and tatters of building material, as if they were the last remaining flames of a great conflagration, staying alive out of pure malice. But as Will and Lyra and the Gallivespians came closer and saw more detail, they picked out many more figures sitting in the darkness by themselves, or leaning against the walls, or gathered in small groups, talking quietly.
Why aren't those people inside? It's cold.
They're not people,
said the Lady Salmakia.
They're not even ghosts. They're something else, but I don't know what.
The travellers came to the first group of shacks, which were lit by one of those big, weak anbaric bulbs on a cable swinging slightly in the cold wind, and Will put his hand on the knife at his belt. There was a group of those people-shaped things outside, crouching on their heels and rolling dice, and when the children came near, they stood up, five of them, all men, their faces in shadow and their clothes shabby, all silent.
What is the name of this town?
Said Will. There was no reply. Some of them took a step backwards, and all five moved a little closer together, as if they were afraid. Lyra felt her skin crawling, and all the tiny hairs on her arms standing on end, though she couldn't have said why. Inside her shirt, Pantalaimon was shivering and whispering,
No, no, Lyra, no, go away. Let's go back, please.
The people made no move, and finally Will shrugged and said,
Well, good evening to you anyway,
and moved on. They met a similar response from all the other figures they spoke to, and all the time their apprehension grew.
Will, are they spectres? Are we grown up enough to see spectres now?
I don't think so. If we were, they'd attack us, but they seem to be afraid themselves. I don't know what they are.
A door opened, and light spilled out on the muddy ground. A man, a real man, a human being, stood in the doorway, watching them approach. The little cluster of figures around the door moved back a step or two as if out of respect, and they saw the man's face, stolid, harmless, and mild.
Who are you?
He said.
Travellers,
said Will.
We don't know where we are. What is this town?
This is the holding area. Have you travelled far?
A long way, yes, and we're tired. Could we buy some food and pay for shelter?
The man was looking past them, into the dark, and then he came out and looked around further as if there were someone missing. Then he turned to the strange figures standing by and said,
Did you see any death?
They shook their heads, and the children heard a murmur of,
No, none.
The man turned back. Behind him, in the doorway, there were faces looking out. A woman, two young children, another man. They were all nervous and apprehensive.
Death? We're not bringing any death.
But that fact seemed to be the very thing they were worried about, because when Will spoke, there was a soft gasp from the living people, and even the figures outside shrank away a little.
Excuse me,
said Lyra, stepping forward in her best polite way, as if the housekeeper of Jordan College were glaring at her.
I couldn't help noticing, but these gentlemen here, are they dead? I'm sorry for asking if it's rude, but where we come from, it's very unusual, and we never saw anyone like them before. If I'm being impolite, I do beg your pardon. But you see, in my world, we have demons. Everyone has a demon. And we'd be shocked if we saw someone without one, just like you're shocked to see us. And now we've been travelling, Will and me. This is Will, and I'm Lyra. I've learned there are some people who don't seem to have demons, like Will doesn't. And I was scared till I found out they were just ordinary like me, really. So maybe that's why someone from your world might be just a bit sort of nervous when they see us, if you think we're different.
Lyra and Will?
Yes, sir.
Are those your demons?
He said, pointing to the spies on her shoulder.
No,
said Lyra, and she was tempted to say, they're our servants, but she felt Will would have thought that a bad idea. So she said,
they're our friends, the Chevalier Tialis and the Lady Salmakia. Very distinguished and wise people who are travelling with us. Oh, and this is my demon,
she said, taking Mouse Pantalaimon out of her pocket.
You see, we're harmless. We promise we won't hurt you. And we do need food and shelter. We'll move on tomorrow, honest.
Everyone waited. The man's nervousness was soothed a little by her humble tone, and the spies had the good sense to look modest and harmless.
Well, though it's strange, I suppose these are strange times. Come in, then. Be welcome.
The figures outside nodded. One or two of them gave little bows, and they stood aside respectfully as Will and Lyra walked into the warmth and light. The man closed the door behind them and hooked a wire over a nail to keep it shut. It was a single room, lit by a naphtha lamp on the table, and clean but shabby. The plywood walls were decorated with pictures cut from film star magazines, and with a pattern made with fingerprints of soot. There was an iron stove against one wall with a clothes horse in front of it, where some dingy shirts were steaming, and on a dressing table there was a shrine of plastic flowers, seashells, coloured scent bottles, and other gaudy bits and pieces, all surrounding the picture of a jaunty skeleton with a top hat and dark glasses. The shanty was crowded. As well as the man and the woman and the two young children, there was a baby in a crib, an older man, and in one corner, in a heap of blankets, a very old woman, who was lying and watching everything with glittering eyes, her face as wrinkled as the blankets. As Lyra looked at her, she had a shock. The blankets stirred, and a very thin arm emerged in a black sleeve, and then another face, a man's, so ancient it was almost a skeleton. In fact, he looked more like the skeleton in the picture than like a living human being. And then Will, too, noticed, and all the travellers together realised that he was one of those shadowy, polite figures like the ones outside. And all of them felt as nonplussed as the man had been when he'd first seen them. In fact, all the people in the crowded little shack, all except the baby who was asleep, were at a loss for words. It was Lyra who found her voice first.
That's very kind of you. Thank you. Good evening, we're very pleased to be here. And like I said, we're sorry to have arrived without any death, if that's the normal way of things. But we won't disturb you any more than we have to. You see, we're looking for the land of the dead, and that's how we happen to come here. But we don't know where it is, or whether this is part of it, or how to get there, or what. So if you can tell us anything about it, we'll be very grateful.
The people in the shack were still staring, but Lyra's words eased the atmosphere a little, and the woman invited them to sit at the table, drawing out a bench. Will and Lyra lifted the sleeping dragonflies up to a shelf in a dark corner, where Tialis said they would rest till daylight, and then the Gallivespians joined them on the table. The woman had been preparing a dish of stew, and she peeled a couple of potatoes and cut them into it to make it go further, urging her husband to offer the travellers some other refreshment while it cooked. He brought out a bottle of clear and pungent spirit that smelled to Lyra like the Egyptian's Geneva, and the two spies accepted a glass into which they dipped little vessels of their own. Lyra would have expected the family to stare most at the Gallivespians, but their curiosity was directed just as much, she thought, at her and Will. She didn't wait long to ask why.
"You're the first people we ever saw without a death,"
said the man, whose name, they'd learned, was Peter.
"Since we come here, that is. We're like you. We come here before we was dead, by some chance or accident. We got to wait till our death tells us it's time."
"Your death tells you?"
"Yes. What we found out when we come here, though long ago for most of us, we found we all brought our deaths with us. This is where we found out. We had them all the time, and we never knew. See, everyone has a death. It goes everywhere with them, all their life long, right close by. Our deaths, they're outside, taking the air. They'll come in by and by. Granny's death, he's there with her. He's close to her. Very close."
"Doesn't it scare you, having your death close by all the time?"
"Why ever would it? If he's there, you can keep an eye on him. I'd be a lot more nervous not knowing where he was."
"And everyone has their own death."
"Why, yes. The moment you're born, your death comes into the world with you. And it's your death that takes you out."
"Ah, oh, that's what we need to know. Because we're trying to find the land of the dead, and we don't know how to get there. Where do we go then, when we die?"
"Your death taps you on the shoulder, or takes your hand and says, 'Come along with me, it's time.' It might happen when you're sick with a fever, or when you choke on a piece of dry bread, or when you fall off a high building. In the middle of your pain and travail, your death comes to you kindly and says, 'Easy now. Easy, child, you come along with me.' And you go with him in a boat out across the lake into the mist. What happens there, no one knows. No one's ever come back.